today on BPR from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. The U.S. has turned its back on climate change. So will you too, or will you double down, as Bill McKibben suggests in the New York Times? We'll ask you. Then it's medical ethicist Art Kaplan on handshakes outlawed at some medical facilities and the White House rolling back birth control mandates for religious employers. Then at noon, it's Emily Rooney as Scott Pelley's dumped at CBS, the public editor's dumped at the New York Times, plus, of course, her list of fulminations and fixations.
The CEO of Mother Jones, the famed muckraking magazine on doing deep dig reporting in the age of Twitter mania. We'll talk to Bo Kenyon, the composer in residence here at the Boston Public Library. We'll open the lines and ask you, okay, the annual National Spelling Bee is over. Now it's your turn. We'll give you the word and you spell it. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH. Live, local talk. Boston Public Radio.
Our withdrawal from the agreement represents a reassertion of America's sovereignty. It is time to exit the Paris Accord.
That was President Donald Trump yesterday. So does this mean it is time for us to reassert our individual sovereignty and take the Paris Climate Accord into our own hands? I am Marjorie Egan. He is Jim Browdy. You are listening to Boston Public Radio. We are broadcasting live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library on a gorgeous, gorgeous day. Hello, Jim.
So is your head still exploding from yesterday, or are you slightly recovered?
Mostly I feel sad.
Yeah.
I feel pretty sad about this.
Well, we're opening up the lines asking you, are you going to be part of the resistance and do your own part to keep up our end of the Paris Agreement? Or are you taking a cue from the president? If he doesn't care about the environment, why should you? 877-301-8970. Some good news for people like Marjorie. Governors, senators, big city mayors, like ours, by the way, have already defied this move. Mayor Walsh did something with Ed Markey yesterday. The mayor of San Antonio tweeted, regardless of Paris Climate Accord withdrawal, we'll remain focused on its healthy and sustainable environmental plan. Governor Baker here tweeted, Massachusetts is aggressively working to exceed the goals of the Paris Agreement on the state level while growing our economy through clean energy, innovation, and environmental stewardship. Republican Senator from Maine, Susan Collins, tweeted, climate change requires a global approach. So, are you going to think global and act local? Are you going to give money to organizations that support the fight against climate change? Are you going to become more environmentally conscious, or are you with the president? Is the environment not a priority for you? 877-301-8970. Our buddy Bill McKibben, who started this whole movement a quarter of a century ago with a great book called The End of Nature, writes in the New York Times, and so we will resist as the federal government reneges on its commitments and the rest of us will double down on ours. 877-301-8970. Before you speak to this, I want to upfront say that Marjorie may not be herself today. No, really. It's 11:10. We have 2 hours and 50 minutes to go. Marjorie is having this existential problem. The house she shares with her sister on the Cape. There's a whole debate. I don't want to get into your private life. But should they have black mulch delivered? Should they have hemlock mulch delivered? She's been on the phone all morning. So, no, I just
I'm
want
upset.
To say, because you're too
I'm
modest.
I'm upset about the mulch.
I know you are. And so if Marjorie isn't up to her... Excuse me, I'm explaining your
okay,
problems.
Okay,
I'll deal
right.
with this.
Thank you.
So if Marjorie isn't up to her usual incredibly high standard today, it's because of the mulch conundrum on Cape Cod. I'm done. Go ahead.
To black the mulch or to brown the mulch or to hemlock the mulch, that is the question.
You know what I didn't say in this question? You know, I was saying you buy into the president doesn't care about, do you care about? I phrased that incorrectly. It's sort of like if the federal government is not going to do this, are some people going to say, what power do I have? We used to say when the federal government was doing it, a lot of people would call us or say to their neighbors, what difference does it make if I recycle a red check for $100? Well, now, if we're backing out of this agreement, I fear there are going to be some people who do throw up their hands and say, this is hopeless.
Well, I hope not. I feel like we have to do our part every day, Jim, because we go through about 10 tons of paper every day, and we have to have those little blue recycling bins. We'd really be
horrible. Well, you hear what Tory
Americans.
Said? Tory, our colleague today, said, can we go paperless?
No, I can't.
I know.
I can't remember all that stuff without the papers in front of me. But it is good to recycle. I think you feel good about recycling. I think you're going to feel good about sending money to people. The thing that makes me really depressed about this, though, is that what I just said to you. it's like, okay, in the whole history of the world, of the planet, since the planet got here, however many millions of years ago that was, the whole world has agreed that we need to save our planet because the planet is overheating and we're going to face very bad consequences. And the only countries that aren't with the rest of the world
are
Syria, Nicaragua,
and
the United States.
Three countries, that's exactly
right.
I mean,
how embarrassing. I just can't believe this.
877-301-8970. So beyond the thing that Markey, and by the way, the senator is going to be with us at the library on Tuesday.
He's been great on this.
Next week. Ed Markey and Marty Walsh do an event yesterday, talk about how the city and the state are going to continue to do what they're doing. You heard what Baker had to say. The governors of California, obviously Jerry Brown, Andrew Cuomo in New York State, and what's his name, Jay Inslee, I think,
from Washington State,
have formed this compact. They announced yesterday they're going to do their thing, despite what Donald Trump and the federal government are going to do.
Other governors are thinking about joining that, too. Yeah, Terry McAuliffe from Virginia, okay. Dan Malloy from Connecticut, and Charlie Baker's issued a statement. It wouldn't be bad to see him join this group as well.
I agree with that completely. So the question is, what are you going to do as an individual? Are you feeling hopeless about this thing, or do you simply agree with the President of the United States and do nothing, or are you going to step it up and double down, as Bill McKibben suggests in his fine piece in today's New York Times?
One of the most interesting things about this is, of course, you can't actually get out of this until
next election.
Yes. November 4th of 2020, I believe, is the date. So this is going to be, needless to say, a big election
issue. But it will be a big election issue. I hope it will be a big election. But even if it turns out we don't do a formal withdrawal, the non-compliance is starting already. When the president's celebrating yesterday, he's going to go to the opening of a coal mine in 2017.
You know how people used to criticize Obama for leading from behind?
Yeah.
Donald Trump is leading backwards. It's like he's in I know he's an older guy, 70 years old, whatever he is, but it's like he's still in the 1900s. You got to come into the 21st century. It's like he's missed the boat on so many things. And when he talks about all these jobs, he's just lying. It's just not true.
877-301-8970. That one other fact that Marjorie failed to mention. She was supposed to. There will be an announcement today at 3. The new Secretary of Coal Mining will be Jared Kushner. Again, taking on. No, because he has so many things that he's doing so well. Let's give him that, too.
That's right.
Let's go to Michael. You are in Framingham. You're first on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library. Thanks for joining us, Michael. Hi.
Hello there, Jim. To me, the biggest issue here is that we're basically going back to after World War II. We did the Marshall Plan. We rebuilt and we became the center foundation block of a stable planet that did a lot of good for us as well as everyone else. And now we're basically ceding that role to China. And a lot of the innovation that that came about, the jobs, the wealth that we gained, it's going to go right overseas.
Yeah,
I agree.
Saying that he's basically going to see, saying that we're being taken advantage of, and he's basically talking us down. He's saying we're weak, and he's making us weak by doing it. And that's just a real tragedy, because it's not just the idea of compliance. It's also, what are you doing with tax credits? What are you doing to incentivize?
I agree.
We're giving a lot of tax credits to the fossil fuel and industry and to the clean energy, and now they're shifting it back. And it's, that's what funds the Islamic terrorists. It's what funds Russia military. It's why they want the Arctic reopened under the Exxon deal, so Putin can rebuild and put more nukes facing us.
So, Michael.
If he doesn't have oil, then he can't do it.
Forget the large policy questions, which you spoke to well. As an individual in Framingham, how's this going to change your behavior, if at all?
Well, I think the only good part of it is that it makes you think about what you're doing.
I agree.
Makes you think about being part of something bigger, and that's a good thing. As sad as it is with all the bad things that came from Trump's election or Russia's electing Trump, the better answer was that we motivated people and we got hundreds of thousands of people on the street. We'll see if we get them to the polls in numbers that overtake what the Republicans tried to suppress.
Got it.
And keep us from being able to keep people. I mean, I don't understand how you keep 600,000. You keep one-third of all of the black Americans in Florida from being able to vote because they had felony convictions, and have that not be racially based and something that is able to...
Well, but Michael, the hopeful sign going forward, because this show, unlike others, is spending less time looking back and rather trying to look forward. the reality is even the Supreme Court of the United States has been really good on some of these issues.
Yeah, they have.
In the last couple of weeks on some of the redistricting issues in North Carolina. So there is some hope. Michael, thank you for your call.
Now, Jim, you're a big recycler, as everyone in Cambridge is, of course.
Of course I am, yes.
Where are you in composting? Should we be composting now in this age of crisis?
Yes, we should.
I'm not really sure how to do it. Do you know how to do it?
You take your stuff, mm-hmm. and then you put it in the composting thing, and then you put it outside in the deal on the sidewalk.
I feel I should start composting.
If you call, I think, the Department of Public Works, mm-hmm. my guess is a lot of communities have this. They deliver one of these little cylindrical things to you, and then you throw the crap in.
Oh, a little
compost
thing.
And then they pick it up, or some such thing.
That's very good.
877-301-8970.
Think about how much everyone's recycling every week, though. You know, sometimes you know if you have a little bit too much stuff, you have a lot of newspapers or cardboard or stuff kind of piled up, and you run around because your recycling bins are full.
Use somebody else's.
And you run around to your neighbors to see if there's any spaces. You know what often happens, Jim?
Yeah.
There's no spaces in there. You know why? Because people are recycling to beat the band.
Mm.
I think that's a very good thing.
Well, Donald Trump's going to end that. That's one of the beauties of his policy. You don't have to worry about full recycling bins. Let's go down to Rhode Island, where Kevin's on the phone. Kevin, thanks for joining us. Hi.
Hey, good morning. Thank you, guys, for taking a call.
Thank you for calling. What's up?
I always enjoy listening to your show. I was trying to get in yesterday and didn't, and I'm glad you're back on it today.
Good. What?
And I saw your show last night, Jim, and they didn't. Sadly, the gentleman, the one supporter of the withdrawal from this accord, wasn't allowed, or nobody would answer his questions, but...
That's Jim Rappaport, former chair of the state Republican Party, for those who don't know.
Right.
So what do you want to say, Kevin?
Well, I spent my career in energy resource activities, the first 10 years in offshore oil drilling and the last 25 years in the energy services industry, which is basically alternative power generation and energy and infrastructure efficiency improvement. And having been in the industry, it's a business-driven model. Nobody is going to withdraw from the efficiency efforts that they're making in corporate America. We're not withdrawing. We're not turning our backs on the environment.
Where would you invest? Excuse me. Where would you? Excuse me. Where would you invest if you were a clean energy company contemplating expanding? Would you be looking to China and the EU, or would you be looking to a country that's in denial?
I wouldn't be looking to a country. I would be looking inward and continue the investments that are being made in wind, solar, fuel cells, biomass, landfill gas.
So you don't
energy,
think this will have any
gamut.
You don't think this will have any impact, is what you're saying?
I absolutely not.
Okay.
Absolutely not. And the reason these corporate boards are mouthing, you know, against Trump and in support, it's strictly PR. I've been in that world. They're going to do what they're going to do, and everybody wants to feel green. And so these corporations and their public image have to look green.
Kevin, with all due respect, if they were on your side, you'd say they're speaking the truth. The fact that they're on the side of the keep staying in the accord, you can't just dismiss them by saying they're worried about a public relations coup. Maybe they actually – did Elon Musk withdraw from that panel as a PR move, or because he
instead of the guy
felt
they
were going the wrong direction? One of the first tweets that went out yesterday, Kevin, you probably know this, is from the new Boston resident, Jeff Immelt, down the street here at GA, who excoriated
the
president.
From General Electric.
Was that a PR move, or is that a guy who really believes this is a disaster? I mean, I would argue he probably knows a little bit about this issue, no?
Yes, he does. Yes, he does. And his company will not change course one iota, whether there's an accord or no accord, as will nobody else.
Okay, we
the
got
fact
it.
Is
but I think, I think it's possible at this stage of the game that people feel there's a real moral issue here, that with the climate in danger, and you read stories about not a long time from now, but 20 years or maybe 30 years from now, 80% of the oceans are going to be so hot that the things that have lived in them for years, like the fish that we eat, are not going to be possible to still live in them anymore.
But Kevin's suggesting we're not going to change. Kevin, thank you for your call. We're glad you got through. He's suggesting that our efforts in that direction are not going to change.
Oh, I don't think that's... I don't think,
I don't agree with him
I don't
either,
think that's
he's
that's
entitled
true
to his opinion.
But on a much more important front...
What's that?
Well, I've been
this
talking about...
This mulch-related?
Well, I'm getting emails about the mulch.
I knew they would.
And I've done an environmentally incorrect thing. I did not know that.
What's that?
Well, Elizabeth, who's a landscape architect, tells me that black mulch is dyed mulch.
Oops.
So I should stay away from that. I should have gotten the hemlock. But the problem is I can't get the hemlock.
We're going to take a break in a second. Why?
Because, well, the guy delivered the wrong color, and now he's delivering the right color and picking up the wrong color.
Oh, that's too bad.
He's coming to take away the hemlock and leave the black mulch, which is the incorrect mulch.
Okay, so Marjorie essentially is siding with Donald Trump on the hemlock, on the mulch, it appears. 877-301-8970.
Oh, my God.
We want to get back. By the way, the goal today was not to debate climate change yet again, even though it's becoming that. Our goal is to say what's done is done, at least for now. What is your reaction? What are you going to do as a result of it, personally?
And when we get back, we're going to play some great sound, my favorite sound of the day, from the mayor of Pittsburgh.
Oh, that is a great sound.
We'll hear from him in just a minute. We're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH, and we are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Come on down. We're here till 2 o'clock. And by the way, did you say this at the top? We are going to have a first in radio ever, maybe.
That's right.
Live juggling. On the radio by two expert jugglers. Really, the most famous woman juggler probably in the world, and Peter Panic, a guy. Now, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the U.S. reneging on the Paris Climate Accord, asking you if you're going to be part of the resistance, as it's called by Bill McKibben, do what you can to support the agreement, or are you taking a cue from the White House? If the president doesn't care, should you? Or, to take Kevin's tact, it's much ado about not much. It's not going to change anything, so you don't have to change anything. 877-301-8970. And by the way, if you want to call, I think we should entertain calls on the whole black versus hemlock mulch issue, because Marjorie's feeling pretty guilt-ridden that she has chosen the environmentally poisonous mulch for
and
her
Erica
house.
And Erica says it really smells bad.
That's great.
So that's very
sounds
upsetting.
Good so far. Carmen and Weston, you're next on Boston Public Radio, and then you can play the sound. I'm sorry, I forgot.
Okay.
Hi, Carmen.
Hello, it's Carmen Elisa. How are you?
Hey, Carmen. Good to talk to you. What's up?
I believe that the main question is how Trump's actions are changing local and state politics mm-hmm. and in the contours of federalism and the 10th Amendment. Because for the longest time, we've been living in the United States where the federal government has a lot of power. But now Trump's actions are taking away the trust that the states have over the government to the point that they are forming a coalition.
Yeah. But Carmen Alicia, the problem with this, and if the alternative is the states doing nothing or the states stepping in where they can, obviously I choose the latter. The problem is, what happens? It's sort of like gun laws. What happens when your state does something really responsible and the next state over does something really irresponsible? Like, for example, New Hampshire on guns versus us. What if New Hampshire says, hey, we're fine with this. We're just going to dishonor the whole accord. We're going to keep polluting or start polluting like crazy. We're going to follow his lead. Sort of cancels out what we do here, which is why we need a federal policy. No?
Oh, yeah, that's the problem. So because of that, many states might end up doing whatever they want. We might end up in front of the Supreme Court because of all these irregularities, that nothing is equal and universal when it comes to matters that affect the whole United States.
Yeah.
But what he's doing is forming a coalition against the federal government within the executive branch.
That is true. That's true.
Yeah, and what I'm doing, I want to run for office because I would like to give some type of guidance in Congress somehow, somewhere in the future.
Well, let us know if you do. Carmen Alicia, thank you very much for the call.
I've never been more enthusiastic about Jerry Brown than I am now. I mean, he's just been great out there in California and all this kind of stuff.
So, by the way, if people know, he's not a kid either.
This is his second round at this.
He's in his mid to late 70s.
Yes, he looks like a million bucks.
And he's a big-time leader on this thing. In fact, some people think, I don't think he's confirmed this, some people think he's thinking of running in 2020.
Really?
Yeah. He did before. And Linda Ronstadt? Was that who it was?
He was dating Linda Ronstadt.
Yeah, Linda Ronstadt. Days.
Back in the day, as it were.
Hate that expression.
Okay. So when the president was out talking about how he was going to get out of the climate accord yesterday, he explained that this is because he wanted to be loyal to the citizens of America. So here's what he said.
No. You have his line here?
Yes. Here's what Trump said yesterday. Explaining why he was withdrawing from the Paris Accord.
I don't think we have that. We have the Pittsburgh mayor's response.
That's what I was going to talk about.
Oh, you said Trump.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't explain it well enough. This is, okay, this is, he was said he was elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not Paris.
Right.
But the Democratic mayor of Pittsburgh talked to CNN, and he was not happy with the comparison. Here it is.
I was outraged that the president would use the city of Pittsburgh as the comparison. What we're doing is we're showing that Pittsburgh is the example. We were that city that China is like today, where the smoke was so, filled the air so much that the streetlights would stay on 24 hours. We were that city that created the first Clean Air Act in American history, decades before there was an EPA.
You know what he did also? Did you read what he did?
What?
No more black mulch in Pittsburgh. Richard in Northridge, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Richard, good to talk to you. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hi there, what's up?
Pleasure to talk to you.
You too.
I just wanted to let you know what I and my colleagues are doing. And we're helping Honduras to meet its Paris Accord commitment.
How are you doing that?
We're using technology that's manufactured here in Massachusetts. It's to dry coffee using 100% renewable energy. Eliminates the burning of wood, which is how the majority of coffee is dried.
Oh, neat.
And we're also partnered with the U.S. Forest Service. We have a new way of growing coffee, which preserves forest habitat. And we just did our first carbon offset trade,
nice,
in which small producers could get credits for sequestering carbon. So we're part of this new renewable energy economy that Trump seems to be shunning.
Who are doing all this wonderful stuff? Who are we?
An NGO, the Mesoamerican Development Institute,
uh-huh,
and we're housed at the University of Massachusetts Lowell.
Oh, great.
And I'm on my way to Lowell now with a load of coffee, Cafe Solar, which is coffee that's processed through the world's first off-grid processing center. It's run by a fair trade cooperative. We train the local youth how to produce their own fuel and run the factory. And the official sustainable coffee of UMass Lowell served in the cafeterias and used as a teaching tool.
Richard, do us a favor. Can you stay on hold? Our producer is going to get your number. We may be in touch with you. Thanks for that call, and thanks for your effort. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970.
Have you mentioned already the real reason that we think that President Trump got out of the Paris Accord?
I've been quoting you every single day. Your position is why he does everything he does. Say what it is. By the way, I subscribe to your theory 100%. So go ahead.
Because
what is
it? Because he's hell-bent on undoing everything Barack Obama did. It's like he's obsessed.
And by the way, let me make your case on this one. If you weren't listening to us yesterday, there are 22 senators in the whole Senate who are with the president on this thing, mm-hmm, not the majority of Republicans.
Right.
For those who say he's doing it for his base, only 17% of America supports the withdrawal. So obviously more than half of his base doesn't support this. All these corporate leaders, including the head of ExxonMobil, past Rex Tillerson,
and
our
local guy now, General Electric.
Right, Immelt, who's obviously at the top of his game. So who is he doing it for? I subscribe to your notion completely. This is about anything that Obama did, I want to undo, a la health care and practically everything else. JB, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, and remember, many people thought that what propelled him to run in the first place was at the Correspondents' Dinner in Washington, D.C., when Barack Obama made fun of him in his performance.
When he was doing all those important things, like deciding whether meatloaf should be...
That's right. And on another point, I want to thank people for emailing me about a mulch. Well, Kathleen told me that black looks much better, and I feel better about that.
No, excuse me. The issue is not... No, excuse me. The issue is not how it looks.
Well,
the issue is what does it do to the environment.
Okay, Edmund told me that all mulch is dyed, so I should calm down.
All mulch has died?
Died.
Okay, fine. So in any case, so the point being, all of it's poisonous. Great.
I guess so.
You're in Wellesley. You're on Boston Public Radio from the library. Hey there, JB. What's up?
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have something to say about everything you're talking about.
Well, I hope so.
Ultimate anti-Trump. One, all mulch has not died. You can buy. I can't tell you where to buy it because then I lose my supply. But black leaf forest mulch, more expensive. That's number one.
Okay,
hold on.
So there is some black mulch that has not died.
Absolutely.
And what's it called?
I have not used dyed mulch in 20 years.
What am I going to do something terrible by using dyed mulch? I've already bought it. It was expensive.
dyed mulches, it smells, it's disgusting, it's not good for plants.
Oh!
Got to make a sacrifice, Marjorie. Oh. By the way, all right. Wildlife will die on Cape Cod. Go ahead, JV, what's your second thing?
I've been generating all of my electricity since 2013 and half of it since 2011. I just dropped my recyclables off at the transfer station, and I drive there in a hybrid car powered partially by the sun. So
how do you generate how do you generate all your electricity, JV?
Solar energy. I have solar energy panels. I bought my panels in America from a company in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And basically there's plenty of ways to save the earth individually. I'm getting crosstalk here, but
that's
anyway,
okay. You did a great job. And if you can deliver the mulch to Marjorie's house tomorrow, that'd
so,
be great.
I mean, am I going to like ruin? You said it was disgusting. Am
yes,
I going to
ruin
bad. Everything?
Yes,
you're
ruining everything.
I've got it. Am I stuck with it now?
Yes,
it's expensive.
You are.
What do I do?
One more thing.
What?
I've been composting for a decade.
Okay, fine. Okay, you're composting.
I just gave my third annual second grade talk
okay,
about
fine.
Composting and worms.
It's excellent. Let's get back to the mulch for Marjorie quickly, JB.
No,
time's
it's,
running
it's
here.
Too late. It's too late for me. Can I get away with it for 1 year and then fix my mistake next year?
Yes or no?
I wouldn't. Don't lose sleep over it. Just start being more healthy about
okay.
Beautiful.
All right,
JB,
thank you.
Thanks for your personal contributions and your advice for Marjorie.
I don't have to lose sleep over it.
I think you should lose sleep over it, by the way. I mean, what's a few hundred dollars for the planet, Marjorie? You have
no,
to decide
I know.
What matters
well,
more.
Listen, I've got two massive piles of mulch now at the house. I can't have a third.
Oh, yes, you can.
Pile.
Oh, yes, you can. You can have an environmentally safe third pile. Let's take one more quick call before
quick
we go.
Okay, quick one. Let's go to Molly in Westboro. Hi, Molly.
Hey, Molly, what's up?
Actually, West Newbury, but thank
West
you.
West Newbury,
close
sorry.
Enough. Hi, what's up?
So I am a longtime Pittsburgh native.
Oh.
And I heard your Mayor Caduto's comment today that you played earlier. My father grew up there when he would change his shirt four times a day. My mother was in charge of a group called GASP, which was Group Against Smog Pollution in the 60s.
Oh, wow.
And they have never looked back. The city is a shining example of what you can do, and the fact that this president, and I use that loosely, is trying to put us back into the coal mine.
Molly, why was there so much smog in Pittsburgh?
Steel.
Was that
Pittsburgh?
It?
Steel. It was a major
steel
producer in North America, back, especially after World War II. But all the mills are gone. In fact, one of the mills is now a location where the Steelers practice their football and the hockey players practice their they're skating. They've rejuvenated it and brought it into an amazing, shining example of what you can do. I live here now. I miss the town. But everything in Massachusetts is really going in the right direction. And the fact that our mayor and governors across the country are standing by it. And I also heard that Bloomberg was going to be funding whatever it is for the accord. So I just love the idea of everything that Massachusetts is standing for, and I just hope that the rest of the state continues recycling and composting. And I just did black mulch as well, so I can sympathize with you, Marjorie.
Was it bad for you? Hold on. Was it bad or okay?
I don't know. I have to look it up now that I listen to you.
Okay.
Molly, thanks for the call.
Molly, did it look nice at least?
It does.
Good. Okay.
Fine.
Well, I could be superficial about it.
Unfortunately, Molly's dog died. I mean, we kept she had it.
Don't
I mean, it's,
say that.
No, I mean,
I have a dog.
You got to deal with truth, Marjorie.
He's getting old.
Facts
he can't take much more stress. Okay, coming up, it might not be good for
physicians. I think you got to just deal with it.
I've been fighting with a guy.
I know you have.
The second kind. I can't tell him
to come
with the third kind.
You made a big mistake, and you got to fix it.
Okay, we're going to talk with our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. Up next, he's going to talk about a physician's bedside manner, a doctor creating a handshake-free zone in his hospital to prevent the spread of disease. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, and we are broadcasting live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. When it comes to the war on drugs, the state of Ohio is flipping the script by suing the pharmaceutical industry for misleading doctors and patients about the dangers of addiction and overdose. And a heads up to the Trump administration, do not be alarmed if activists dressed as handmaids darken your door in protest of that decision to roll back the birth control mandate for religious employers. Join us online for his take on these and other medical ethical headlines, including the ethics of pulling out of the Paris Accords, is Art Kaplan. Art is the doctors William F. and Virginia Connolly Mini Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Medical Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the excellent Everyday Ethics podcast. Hey there, Art.
Hi, Art.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent, thanks.
Terrific. Well, before we get back to Ohio and birth control, let's start with what Jim just mentioned, the ethics. Are there ethical issues around getting out of the Paris Climate Accord?
Yes, because basically you're trying to figure out what are the interests and how do you protect the well-being of future generations. And it's a classic moral trade-off. People want jobs now. People want less regulation now, or many people do. And others are saying, but look, your grandchildren, their children, they're going to be living in an uninhabitable planet with the results of the current generation's waste unless we do something. And I think while certainly the future generations, you know, it's hard to envision them. They don't have names. They're kind of this vague, abstract thing. They have a moral claim on us. So what Trump is doing to me is flat out immoral. You can't just say, well, we're going to pollute the planet, dump all kinds of CO2 into the atmosphere, make it a hot hellhole, flood everything from Boston to Miami to Mar-a-Lago, and then leave that mess for the next generation to figure out. It's not right.
So will you be filing suit in the International Ethics Court tomorrow, Art? I mean, that's part of the problem, right?
More, I'll be saying, look, that kind of a decision is so morally vacuous, so troubling, that what I'd like to see happen is some shift in Congress to bring pressure back to say, nope, that's not the policy we ought to be following. To me, this is a moral issue that gets a political resolution.
Do you think there's any kind of organized medicine response in the offing?
You know, it's not as loud as I might wish. You know, the climate scientists were sort of over in one corner yelling and saying the policy he put out isn't consistent with the science, not consistent with the facts, and then the sort of impact of medicine far less so. And to be honest, it's partly because climate impact is more public health. There are not a lot of people that work in the space.
Yeah.
It's a little bit neglected, so you don't hear the doctors quite as loudly as I would wish. It's even true in the ethics crowd. You know, there are a few people who pay attention to environmental ethics, but you'd think, given what I just said about the duties to the next generation, the duties to our children is what I'm talking about, that you'd hear more screaming and saying, this choice is just wrong, it's untenable from an ethics point of view.
Speaking of duties to our children, Art Kaplan, medical ethicist, State of Ohio has filed a lawsuit against the pharmaceutical industry over the opioid epidemic, basically saying that a bunch of drug companies engaged in marketing campaigns that misled doctors and patients. You know, based on the videos I've seen, including the first video ever of in the 90s, what's the famous opioid that where the doctor has that smiley face in the white jacket and he's saying how great it is and how healthy it is and how unaddictive it is? I'll think of the drug in a minute. But it seems to me this is almost like one of these cases where there doesn't even need to be a trial. Is it not proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that the marketing campaigns have been deceitful and misleading?
Marketing campaigns were morally scurrilous, bribing docs to prescribe the drug, basically kickback programs. We know that's true. And there are only, I think it's something like 100 doctors roughly have prescribed like 93% of all the addictive pain-relieving drugs that are out there. We know that the evidence used was false in terms of safety. We also know that there was a single paper, a kind of letter to the editor that was published, I don't know, way back when that smiley face campaign was on TV, that basically said, I've used these drugs and they don't seem to be addictive. It was literally like a case report. And in fact, the industry, the pain med industry, distorted it, ran with it, It wasn't even a study, and basically started saying, look, everybody, this guy says it's not addictive. That must be true. Worse still is it took too long to get this thing to the attention of criminal prosecution, because we now have an addictive pain med problem that's out of control, whether it's Tiger Woods, Rush Limbaugh. You can go down a list of celebrities who are all having problems with pain meds. We've talked about it before. You got this opioid epidemic that's killing people all over the country. Who was it? The New Hampshire governor said it was his number one priority. Or was
Vermont.
It Vermont.
We actually had him in the studio talking about it. Yeah, his whole State of the State speech, Peter Shumlin, 100% of it was about the opioid epidemic.
Right. And so it's killing people at an incredible rate. I even think it's part of the reason, to tell you the truth, if not a cause, then a symptom of how Trump got elected, the bane of desperation and so forth, sweeping through kind of Rust Belt America, with people turning to drugs and winding up dead. It's kind of a poor white working class plague that no one paid attention to. So I think these guys ought to be paying fines, going to jail, but it took too long to get there. It tells me that the system we have for monitoring the abuse, the outright abuse of pharmaceutical drugs, just isn't up to it.
I have a couple of things. One, it was obviously OxyContin I was talking about. It was a Purdue Pharma ad with a doctor in the white coat saying how safe it was. But, you know, you mentioned the race angle. One of the most powerful pieces I ever read in the New York Times, and it was not an editorial, about a year ago, proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that lawmakers in this country cared not at all about this issue until it started affecting white people. And the causal connection is so intense. But I want to get to the litigation. The guy who's behind this is the Attorney General of Ohio, Mike DeWine. And by the way, I knew him. He was a congressman from Ohio when I used to be lobby for legal services. The irony is he was as horrible on poor people's issues, including access to courts, as anybody I've ever lobbied. Now he's this hero. But what comes of this? So they get damages. There should be criminal prosecutions. These people should go to jail. Is anybody going to jail? Will anybody go to jail?
Probably one or two of the frontline over-prescribing docs, and by the way, nurses, too, could prescribe in some instances here. They'll probably wind up.
But how about the corporate executives? That's the one.
Nope.
Those, no.
Nope. I don't think we're going to see any perp box of the execs. I don't, and I don't know why not. That's what I meant when I said the system isn't up to holding people to account for developing marketing schemes. You know, what they did was they'd say this drug is approved for somebody who has horrible cancer and terrible pain. But, you know, if you listen to the show and you hear our captain, it might give you a headache, and, hey, you know, it's kind of a safe drug. Why don't you take that during that 20-minute interlude?
Okay, our Kaplan, our medical ethicist, this one really puts me through the roof.
I know that.
The Trump administration has followed through to roll back federal requirement that many religious employers provide birth control coverage in their health insurance plans. And the reason it drives me so crazy is I'm saying to myself, where are all these deeply committed Americans who are so opposed to birth control? Where are these families with 8 children and 10 children and 14 children? I guess they were the Dugars. They had like 19 children, but then their son was molesting 4 of the little sisters, so they didn't turn out to be a paragon of religious probity. And Hobby Lobby, as you know, which started this whole suit, can't have any birth control for the women. But the men, not just Viagra,
Neil Gorsuch,
but
by the way,
vasectomies. So why am I wrong when I think this is sort of a yet another attack on women? I mean, what's...
You're not. It is. I think it is. But I'm really pounding my moral desk today. I think the Trump thing, the climate revision, is immoral. I think it's immoral not to send these corporate guys to jail. And I'm going to come out and say, I understand it's a religious point of view about birth control.
Who?
An unethical policy. It's completely from the Middle Ages. Are you kidding me? You're not going to let people use birth control? I mean, you know, I've said this to both of you, I'm a big fan of the current Pope. He's the last voice out there for social justice, kind of in a dark and dim world out there. But the idea that it is somehow unethical to let people use birth control is just wrong. What's the argument for that? I mean, let's get right back to the basic core argument. I could say from a religious point of view, I'm a Jehovah's Witness. I think blood transfusions are immoral. Could I then come up with a health plan that says, hey, we'll cover everything but blood transfusion because it's against my religion?
Yeah.
First of all, it's a crummy policy, outdated. The blood transfusion thing doesn't make any sense. I'm not saying I wouldn't defend somebody's right as an adult to say they don't want it, but it doesn't make, I'm not going to say that it makes moral sense to say I'm against blood transfusion, and that's how I feel about contraception. It's like we didn't have that technology for a long time. We have it now. Why wouldn't anybody, man or woman, be allowed to control whether they want to reproduce or not? What's the argument?
Well, you know, in defense of the Pope, the Catholic Church is officially opposed to birth control, but how often has he even mentioned it? Almost never. He's criticized the church.
Oh, yeah. I think he gets it.
Yeah.
It's a tough call for him to
try and take
on every single issue, whether it's women priests or birth control or why capitalism, raw capitalism, might be immoral. I understand that. But still, it's a fundamentally flawed argument. Then, to say that you're a public corporation and you're going to hire people of all faiths and you're going to impose your religious view on them, I get it why you might say, well, look, as a Catholic nursing home with Catholic employees, or you give me the whatever the place is that just has people of the same religion working there, okay, that's one thing. But to say, if you work here, we get to dictate our moral point of view and impose it on you as a matter of conscience, that leads to crazy situations out there where your boss says, you know, I'm morally opposed to golf and tennis. I think they're a waste of time. We're never going to hire anybody who golfs. You know, I mean, it's like you don't really want to go down this road. It's not the way to handle the issue. And let me, I'm frothing here. If you really want to fight about birth control, then treat it as a moral issue and convince people not to use it. Don't impose it as a coverage limit. Say, you know, it's out there, but here's why you shouldn't use it. Where's that argument?
You know, I'll tell you one last thing about the Pope. Obviously, giving his encyclical, a signed copy of his encyclical on climate change, really had an impact on Donald Trump.
Exactly.
So, can we? You wrote one last moral outrage, and then we'll get to I was going to say immoral issues, non-moral issues, amoral issues. You wrote a piece, I think it was in the New York Daily News, about liver transplants. I have to say, and I have nothing to do with them, I was outraged about this. Can you describe the whole inequity thing and in the whole liver transplant system in America?
So a long time, many years ago, when we first started doing liver transplants, the country was divided up into, I don't know, let's say 12 regions. And when you got an organ, say in New England, it tended to stay in New England, and that was the region where the organ was obtained from someone who died. It kind of got distributed locally. What's happened over time is there have been shifts in where the transplant centers are. So there are many more in Boston, New York, Philly, L.A., and the old regions are still in place. So people in Tennessee or Kentucky, they have a big advantage in getting a liver because they have fewer transplant centers there. So they're competing, if you will, for a bigger part of the pie. We need to recalibrate the system so that it's consistent with where we are today, not from 1985, so that everybody has an equal chance to get a liver transplant.
So why isn't it just done? I mean, it's so pathetically obvious. What's the argument against this? The only argument is we have more of them, so we don't want to give them up?
Yep, and they make us a lot of money. Remember, a liver transplant is highly profitable, so centers say, hey, you know, there are long waiting lists. But if we can do more of them in Tennessee than you can do in Massachusetts, we're making more money. So too bad. There's one other reason it doesn't shift. Very rich people. Remember Steve Jobs got a liver transplant? Mm-hmm. Do you remember that?
Yeah, and it was
late
suspect,
in the game.
Right?
He went to Tennessee,
didn't
he?
California to Tennessee.
That's what I remember, yeah.
So he was rich enough in a way to relocate into the region. There's no prohibition against that, although I've been bellyaching against that for a long time, too. So the rich kind of escape, and then there isn't as much political pressure to make the change. But the change is so overdue, it's crazy.
You know, one last thing about this. I know we asked you this a year ago, and I forgot what your answer was. House of Cards is just back on the air. Remember the whole House of Cards transplant issue when the chief of staff to the Kevin Spacey was telling the woman who's in charge of the system, manipulate it, pop the president up one, and she says it can't be done even if I wanted to. Can it be done? Can political – I understand the Steve Jobses of the world can move themselves. Can it be politically manipulated, or is it insulated from
it's hard. I wouldn't say never. It's hard because basically biology gets in the way. Not everybody can take a liver from everybody else. They got to match. Blood types have to be the same, so that's a problem. But if you want to game the system, you just say, well, the president or Jim, they're very sick and they're going to die sooner, so we got to move them up the list, and that's where you could budget somewhat.
Okay,
we're talking
with
Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist. Art, tell us about this proposal or idea about handshake-free zones in hospitals. What's this about?
Oh, we're coming into our freak-out gym.
Our germ segment.
Which I enjoy tremendously. So, as we all know, the fist bump has slowly replaced the handshake in terms of communicable disease. Or, if you're Jim, it's been replaced by the wear a baggie over both your hands and go about traveling around Boston that way. But it's basically infection control. It's basically saying, look, the practice, at least in the hospital setting where you got a lot of people with immune problems and some really nasty bugs circulating, let's tamp it down. It makes sense. It would also make sense if people would really practice good hand hygiene. You know, we try to get everybody to wash their hands all the time. There's Purell all over the place. If you've been in a hospital or nursing home, you've probably seen it. So the next bit of advice is it doesn't kill germs if you wave your hands under the Purell dispenser, put a drop on them, rapidly rub them together, and move on. You got to really wash them.
Yeah, but can I say one thing about this? I don't want to get obsessed on it, but the doctor who's behind this thing, he does – Slavinsky or whatever his name is here.
Yeah, yeah.
He does a study, and the study that they do, and it's then published in the American Journal of Infection Control, doesn't even decide whether it's effective. It does something stupid like saying it is possible to reduce the frequency of handshakes. I mean, duh. I mean, what did that add to the debate, Art Kaplan? We still don't know if it really makes a difference, do we?
Well, we don't, and I'm not sure it's possible to reduce the frequency of handshakes because a lot of patients are going to be insulted.
Exactly. That was my next point.
Yeah. So you can try to encourage people to think about it. That's the best you can do. Say, you know, hey, I'd like to shake your hand, but, you know, I'm a filthy blob of infestation, so you don't want to really touch me, patient. So let me just give you the old fist bump or the royal salute or whatever the hell it is. You're right. It is going to take a culture change to really do anything about it.
And I don't want there to be a culture
deeply
change.
Deeply embedded in our culture.
Hi, Kaplan, medical ethicist. I want you to know Jim Browdy was way ahead of this story because he was disappointed in the performance of his snug-fitting compression tights.
But I wasn't wearing them for exercise purposes.
Yeah. Supposedly, there's these there are these tights made by Nike that were supposed to, I guess, tamp down on muscle vibrations and let you endure longer and get less tired. But there's a snag,
so to speak.
They don't work, and the funding of the study was a little weird, too.
No, it wasn't weird. That's why this story is so great.
I got this on the agenda because I wanted to have a happy ethical moment.
Exactly.
Today.
Okay, that Nike
raving,
was ethical.
Screaming and yelling.
Okay.
But here's the good news. These compression socks, they're supposed to stop muscles from bouncing around when you're running. You know, it wastes energy. Their muscle movement, I can't imagine that anybody, unless you're an Olympic-level athlete, would notice this difference. But okay. They were selling, and Nike makes, a lot of these compression tights for runners. They funded studies to prove that there was some value in this, and they got negative results. And to their credit,
they admitted it.
Nike put it out there. Yeah. Nike said, doesn't work.
Has that ever happened? Is there another major – I know it's not a major issue. An industry-funded study
– everybody's got compression
which comes out on the wrong side from the perspective of the industry, and they publish the study. How often do you see that?
Rarely. That's why I was so pleased to see this. Sometimes my industry friends say, how do we get more credibility for industry-sponsored studies? Here's the answer.
Yeah, print some bad ones. Exactly.
Yep.
Now, Art, you were the one that convinced me to stop buying multiple vitamins because you said they're pointless. I've saved tens of dollars. The issue for me now off this study...
I got to put in my little insert.
Oh, God.
With the exception of vitamin D, which some people...
Oh, I take vitamin D.
Yeah.
I do. Thank you. Okay, don't ask why, Marjorie. And secondly, so based on this...
Does that have to do with compression problem?
I was going to say, based on this compression tights issue, should I be getting rid of all my Spanx or should I not?
Well, if you wear Spanx because you think they're going to conserve your energy, Jim, then I would get rid of them. If you think they're helping you maintain a svelter appearance, that one's up to you.
The only problem is every time I wear them, I can't breathe for days. Yeah. They're really tight. I look good, but I can't breathe. So, Art, what's with the everyday ethics?
By the way, they're at least an improvement over the... 19th century version, which was the corset,
corset.
I think people had ribs removed and were squeezing themselves.
Just since we're talking about this, maybe, Marjorie, you know the answer. I don't understand how Spanx are not like whack-a-mole, meaning your body's got to go somewhere. And if it squeezes you into a smaller place, doesn't the excess come out somewhere?
By the way, I'm going to forego talking about everyday ethics and what's coming just to get this answer.
Well, my understanding is if you have a significant issue, that the Spanx will start at your neck and go right down to your ankles.
So it comes out your toes.
Make your fat head.
Okay.
Make your head fat.
So what is your everyday ethics podcast deal there, Art Kaplan?
So we're going to go into the murky world of vaccination this week. Both people continue to see outbreaks. We had one in Minnesota because anti-vaxxers went up there and told a whole lot of people not to use vaccines. And then people travel, go to places where there are things like measles rampant, and all of a sudden they have 60 people in the hospital in the state of Minnesota. So, again, I believe in people's rights. But at some point, your rights have to be bounded by what's either good for your neighbor or the future generations. And that takes us back to why Donald Trump is morally deaf.
Yeah, I don't want to criticize you, by the way, but you got to, on the podcast, if you want it to be a success, you got to play the hits, Art. I'd be doing Spanx instead of vaccines if I were you. But you do what you think is right, and we'll do what we think is right, okay?
Okay.
Take care, Art.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful weekend. Art Kaplan joins us every week. He's the Doctors William F. and Virginia Committee Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. He is also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast. Coming up, Emily Rooney is here for her famous list of obsessions, objections, preoccupations, whatever. She is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
At noon on BPR from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, it's Emily Rooney. As Scott Pelley's dumped at CBS, who's next? The New York Times public editor's dumped too, and tweeters will take her place. Plus, of course, her list of fulminations and fixations.
The CEO of Mother Jones, the muckraking magazine on doing deep dig reporting in the age of Twitter mania. We'll talk with Beau Kenyon, the composer in residence here at the Boston Public Library. We'll open the lines and ask you, okay, the National Spelling Bee is over. Now it's your turn. We'll give you the word and you spell it. Then our news quiz featuring two local jugglers. And guess what? They'll be juggling Jim live right here at the Boston Public Library. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH, and since it's Friday, we are broadcasting live from our beautiful WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Hi, Emily.
Hey, Marjorie. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Jim.
Where there
what
will
a
be live juggling,
jugglers.
Excuse
I can't
me,
wait.
On the radio or in person. If you come here. By the way, before we introduce Emily formally, we continue to take emails on the black mulch conundrum.
Oh, yeah.
So if anybody has any input about
I'm
the environmental impact.
And,
Did you buy red?
No, I bought black.
Oh.
Robert told me that the previous person complaining about the black mulch was a black mulch alarmist.
Oh. Well, that's not what I'm reading. In any case, joining us for her famous list of fixations and fulminations is Emily Rooney, host of Beat the Press. Emily, it's nice to see you.
It's great to be here. What a beautiful day this is.
I know. It's an absolutely gorgeous day. It's going to be a nice weekend, at least for part of it.
Really?
Anyway. I think so. So Scott Pelley is leaving CBS News.
He got booted. Let's be frank here.
He got booted. He got booted because he's in third place?
Yeah, but he's been in third place. The interesting thing about this is that when he first took over 6 years ago, the numbers moved measurably. I mean, he picked up like 1.4 million more viewers than Katie Couric had. But that just kind of plateaued. He hasn't really lost that many. He's lost a few, but it plateaued. I think this has more to do with the fact that he's been taking Donald Trump on. And David Rhodes, who's this young news president, I think the youngest news president ever in the history of network news. I know they've locked horns over a lot of issues, including his contract in the past, but my guess is that he felt like Scott Pelley just had too much power, was a runaway train. Because, let's face it, they don't have anybody to put in there.
I'll tell you who they should put in there.
Nor O'Donnell.
Anderson Cooper.
Not going to happen.
Why isn't it going to happen?
Because Anderson Cooper is not a straightforward news guy. They can't do it.
And he's
already got his own show.
Excuse me. Besides that, I would almost think it's a demotion to go from CNN at night.
You have a lot more viewers.
It's not a demotion.
The people that are watching the nightly news are fewer. They're older.
No, they're not.
No.
Fewer than they're used to be.
Yeah,
and
but
I still think
44 million viewers in Toto.
Do you watch the nightly news?
I do.
No, I don't.
Neither do I.
You know, we talk about Scott Pelley for a minute. We've been praising him here, and I have to say, if the reason he was canned is because he took on Trump, you and we have discussed what has troubled me from time to time about straight reporters and anchors crossing the line. It's something we're going to talk about in terms of the public editor in a minute in the New York Times. I think Pelley is straddled the
totally
line
agree.
Beautifully and responsibly.
Totally agree.
He's been critical, but in a fact-based kind of way. He's
totally
not editorializing.
Agree. I mean,
so if that's the reason, I feel horrible about it.
The most qualified reporter that they've ever put in that anchor chair, with the exception of maybe Peter Jennings or somebody that was ABC. But you know what I mean? I mean, Anthony Mason, I happen to believe he's one of their correspondents, one of the best street reporters in the history of network news. He's not an anchorman.
He's the fill-in for those.
But I mean,
who don't
why
know
would
him.
They be? Why would they even have him fill
so
in?
So why do you think the rush has to do with Trump?
You know what I think happened?
What?
I think Scott Pelley legitimately went on a foreign trip to do a piece for 60 Minutes. Mm-hmm. He was already had wind that they were going to bump him. He phoned into his office and says, "You know what? Screw them. Move my office." The staffers started moving his office. It got leaked out to Page Six. Richard Johnson. Richard Johnson printed it, and it happened ahead of schedule, which is why they're letting him come back next week. He's going to actually be at the.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
So
Page Six, by the way, for the three people who don't know, is of the gossip page of the New York Post.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's why Donald Trump has had such a difficult time with the media, because he dealt mostly with the gossip reporters when he was with the tabloids in New York City, and it was a much different standard than if you're dealing with news reporters.
I feel horrible about this. I know Scott, who's considered kind of imperious and a bit of a bully, sort of in the style of one of those network news guys, really ran the show and butted heads with a lot of people. But he earned his due, and he was.
I
thought they should put in Nora O'Donnell, but they've already poo-pooed that because she does so well in the morning. They've already got they have Lester Holt on NBC. They can't pluck another young white guy to go up
David
against
David Muir.
Kind
of
they
thing,
can't
yeah.
do that.
I agree with that.
It's not going to be Jeff Glor. Jeff Glor, who used to be here in Boston, Channel 7, he does The Weekend. I cannot imagine.
Telling you, Anderson Cooper. You watch.
Yeah.
Anderson Cooper.
I hope not, because that would ruin the lineup on CNN at night, which is more interesting to me.
How about Oprah, as long as you're thinking out of the box?
What, do you know something we don't know?
Oprah's going to be on 60 Minutes. I mean, if all
but wait
bets
a second.
Are off.
Can she be president of the United States and be the anchor on the CBS Nightly News
imagine?
Or not?
That would be fascinating, wouldn't it? That would be absolutely fascinating. So let me ask you about 60 Minutes now with Scott Pelley on the other trip. Because Megyn Kelly is debuting
Sunday night, right?
Against 60 Minutes this Sunday.
I know, that's not
going to
work. I mean, I think she's going to get some curiosity eyeballs, but that's not going to work.
For her, you mean?
Yeah.
Why not?
I just think 60 Minutes remains an incredible powerhouse.
Yeah. So where would you put Megyn Kelly? She had massive ratings when she was at Fox.
I'd put her on the anchor desk at CBS News. They missed that window.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what should be happening. They, yeah. Bingo. If they had her in their left pocket, can you imagine?
Well, you know, also, you made me a big fan of hers, by the way. I poo-pooed her early on.
She's really smart.
I like her.
But she is really good. She was so great in that first debate, yeah. which we'll remember for yeah. the rest of our lives.
God.
I mean, she was amazing. But, you know, having said that, some people have the skill to do what they're doing brilliantly
yeah.
and have to recognize that. The one magazine thing I've ever seen her do was that embarrassment
awful,
with Donald
awful.
Trump.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people say her bosses said she had to do what she did do. It was humiliating.
Well, you don't want her to do softball stuff.
No.
I don't want to see her doing features.
Well, what
features.
Is she going to do?
Well, I don't know. We'll find out. I think it is going to be much more softball than certainly what she was
got,
doing.
She scored the interview with Putin.
Yeah.
So that's going to happen.
Yeah, which will be fantastic, yeah. to watch. But the thing I love about
Megyn
Kelly...
He's doing it bare-chested, by the
yeah.
way. Did you hear that?
especially for Megyn. Is Megyn Kelly is a gorgeous-looking yeah. woman. And you see a lot, if you watch Fox and Friends in the morning or some of these shows on Fox, you have these gorgeous-looking women who really don't know what they're talking about.
I know, she does.
And she was would take on Bill O'Reilly, and she beat him at her own debate. She's a lawyer. She's really quick. She's
yeah.
really smart. So I felt it was sort of an insult to,
yeah.
to women to have these women that just were there in the cocktail dresses saying nothing, and she's in the cocktail dress holding her own.
That was, you know... all by probably dumb luck because she probably got the job originally because she was so good looking.
Maybe.
But, you know,
right.
she's just
and
another one of the Fox babes, and it turns out, wait a minute.
Exactly. I remember seeing her years ago with O'Reilly.
Yeah,
I'm thinking she shut him right down,
yeah,
which isn't
yeah.
easy to do because yeah. no matter what you think of him, he's a very yeah. smart guy.
You know, we've mentioned this before. I don't know if it's you. Do you ever see the movie Outfox, the documentary?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they talked about, for those who haven't seen it, it's about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
They talked about how, well, a lot of people like me praised Bill O'Reilly for having the other side on, which people like Sean Hannity don't do. There was a conscious decision on Fox News when you had a liberal on. This is what the documentary said, so don't blame me. They picked the least attractive person with the worst personality, television
well, look
personality.
At Alan Combs.
Alan Combs was the example
yes.
they chose, actually.
Yeah.
And they actually picked an example of a person who lives in Boston who
I know
we
who
shall remain unnamed.
I know
in any case, we're talking Emily Rooney of Beat the Press. So speaking of getting dumped,
yeah.
The public editor, otherwise known as ombudsperson,
yes.
for lack of a better expression, at Liz Spade, is that how you say her
Liz
last
Spade,
name?
Yeah.
Was dumped at the New York Times. And beyond your response to this, to me, the most embarrassing part of this is either the head guy or the number two guy at the New York Times saying, well, what are you going to replace her with?
The internet.
Says tweeters
it's
are going to serve the purpose of the public editor of the
I
New York Times.
This.
Yeah, we're going to talk about
what's,
that.
What's going on?
So just for a little history... Back in 2006, if you don't remember the Jason Blair story,
yes.
this is this made, you know, young African-American reporter. Mostly he's a fabricist.
He made
you're
he
right. Yeah, you're right.
He did do
you're
some right. plagiarizing because if he didn't go to the story, then he sourced AP and other wire services and took quotes that other people had gathered. But he made up these phantasmagorical stories, and it went on and on and on until an editor called him out on it. And that's the first time they hired a... public editor Dan Okrent, who
mm-hmm.
actually lives in Wellfleet. He's a local guy here.
He did a terrific job.
Yeah, he was really one of the better. And then everybody had it for about a year. Now, Liz has only been in the job for 5 months, I think. So then I even get to let her finish her term.
And they're independent. Even though they're paid by
yes.
the Times, they're independent.
Totally independent.
Yeah, okay.
So
very
they can,
popular
they can write
the,
whatever they want.
In the newsroom.
I love the best one they ever had, by my thinking, was Margaret Sullivan.
Oh, yeah, she was
terrific.
Who's
now the media critic for the
Washington Post. Yeah.
I mean, it's a cost-saving move. Any way you look at it, that's what it is. Because they're also letting go 100 other people, and then they say they're going to narrow the reporter-to-editor ratio or
well,
something
but
like
wait,
that.
Well, cost-saving in part, but it's clear that they inside were not happy with some of the stuff that she was writing. The thing that I
they
thought
never
she,
liked it.
The thing that I thought she hit
yeah.
right on the head perfectly was the topic we were just discussing. She took to task some of the straight reporters at the New York
yeah.
Times
yes.
for their tweeting,
yes.
which was
right.
essentially
yeah,
opinion.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think she got it, and they were
yeah.
really upset
they
with her
mad.
About that.
Yeah.
So I think it's a part, and they used the financial thing as an excuse.
They've always been annoyed by the ombudsperson, so I don't know why all of a sudden it reached critical
So who
mass.
Still has one?
Nobody.
The Boston Globe used to have Mark
Jerkowitz,
who used to be on your show
yep.
all the time.
Oh, but yeah. then, oh, they had that other guy, McKimmon.
I don't remember.
Bill
So wait a second. So no major American newspaper
Washington
has?
Post got rid of theirs, too. So I can't think of anybody who does.
That's pretty incredible.
I mean, I thought it was a good feature, and I enjoyed it.
So did I. Well, again, for those who think that we are joking, literally one of the two leaders of the New York Times said
yeah.
people who tweet will serve the purpose. And what
well,
they say is something I didn't know, and Marjorie said she didn't either. We were talking about this morning. The editor of the New York Times said that currently they only allow comments on 10% of their stories,
which I was
surprised. I know you don't comment on obituaries. Brian McGorry's told us that and other things. But so they're going to raise the percentage, and then theoretically, the commenters, most of whom live in their mother's basements,
exactly.
I should say, and people on Twitter are going to serve the function.
And there's
it's
no
ridiculous.
Fact basis.
Exactly.
And by the way, one of the things that the public editor gets to do is debrief the reporters, which I think is fascinating. Now they have that great podcast that I know you like, The Daily.
Oh, she
yes.
loves
but,
it, yeah.
But debriefing the reporters about how they came to something or how they why they reported something. No Twitter is going to get the opportunity
well,
to do
by
that.
The way, let me give another plug to The Daily because I do love it. And they do
say what it is for those
well,
who
it's
don't
a
know.
Daily, it's a daily podcast by the New York Times. Michael Barbaro is the reporter. And he will interview the reporter mm-hmm. that did the story
yeah.
of the day. And often you find out much
yeah,
more
yeah,
than
yeah.
this is in the actual story and the reaction the reporter got to the story and blah, blah, blah. And it's only like 20 minutes in the morning. They have the main feature. Then they say, here's what else you need to know today.
Sometimes I get nervous listening to that because the reporters talk like this and then like that and then like this and they go, oh, my gosh. They're much better with the written
yeah,
word.
Yeah, well, that's true. But they'll have them go right up to the desk, call them
yeah.
on the phone. Mm. You know, are you
and
there?
And then I'm like, oh,
yeah. But it's good and it gives you the news of the day, yeah. the big story in great detail. So, Emily Rooney, I understand
yes.
You want to discuss
I have
this,
a bee under my bonnet.
This sting of this yeah. Dorchester minister and several other men who were caught in a sting
right.
operation.
So this is going to end
a
up in a bad place.
It's going to end up bad.
Right now.
When
go
I
ahead.
First got to Boston.
Tell people the story, by the way.
The big stories were, let me gear you up to it, were, yeah. you know, 3 alarm fires in Chelsea mm-hmm. and prostitution stings. I mean, every other day there was some kind of a prostitution sting. You know, round them up. You know, they do a sting where they set something up, and it wasn't with cell phones, but it was some other ploy in the newspaper like that. And then they'd round up all these Johns and then parade them before the media. Okay, this is nothing more than an old-fashioned prostitution ring. And these guys, some of them were fairly prominent. One was a minister.
Yes.
One was a court officer.
Gave some blessing.
A minister
to Charlotte
gave the blessing
Baker.
To Baker and
yeah,
his wife
yes.
at his
it was a prostitution
inauguration
ring.
Or his election.
But now we have elevated it. And I actually debriefed. I talked to Philip Martin, one of our reporters at GBH, who's done a lot with human sexual trafficking.
Yeah, yes.
Oh yes.
He says, let's not
all over
confuse
the, world.
The two things. This is not human sexual
okay,
trafficking.
Okay.
What's
the
definition?
Know?
This is, because it's prostitution.
What's the difference?
Yeah, but many, if you read the, many,
no,
many of these,
difference.
Excuse me, many
look it up,
of
Google
these,
it.
Many of these young women
we don't know
have
who,
been trapped. No, you don't know that
no,
she's
you don't
not.
Know either.
You just know that it was.
No, it's a prostitution.
And, you don't know that.
But, well, I don't know. But it's not. It's,
so are most of the young women, Emily,
I don't know if they're young.
Who are prostitutes?
I have
most,
no idea.
Most of those who are young women
but,
who are prostitutes, are they not trafficked?
In other, mostly in, you know, Thailand and places like that, but here it doesn't work like that. They're not rounded up at age 13 years old, and it's not the way it works.
Well, I don't know. There was just that whole big piece about sex
Let's
trafficking.
Let's find out who they are
on television, and some of these were girls.
This
that
seemed to me
were seduced
to be
by
really
guys.
We
have interviewed some of these women on the show
yes.
here.
This seemed to be a really low light. I mean, I felt embarrassed for our law enforcement in some respects. You know, naming these guys. It's like, you know, there's still movement afoot to make prostitution legal. There's
then
a lot
we should make it legal and have
but,
big
but
brothels.
But to have this, you know, this
and
poor
you can
minister,
go off and do
so
it.
So he wanted to pay for sex for an hour. You know what I say? Big deal.
But the thing is, I don't think human trafficking is unique to, is not happening
well,
right here.
We're using that term because that's what Dan Conley used. But I noticed today
no, we're using
that the
it.
Boston Globe backed off and they're calling it a prostitution sting. There's a big difference.
Okay. But if you're
and
a
it's
14,
not a big deal.
But if
you
were
it's
14
a huge
16,
deal.
Hold on, can I get my
human trafficking is a huge
right.
deal. Right. That
can
not get, necessarily.
And the fact that you were attempting to say that they have nothing to do with one another.
No,
it
they're two different things.
No, they can be two different
two
things.
Two different things.
But often, in overwhelming percentages, if young
know.
Women are involved in this, they are not doing it voluntarily.
I don't know. I don't know about this country. I know. I know that's certainly
well,
true.
We do know about this country because I've read a
ton of
stories.
And other
here's
countries.
What happens: it's like some 14 or 15 year old girl, some cute guy who turns out to be a pimp, seduces her, gets her hooked on drugs, and takes her from Rhode Island to Massachusetts or from Maine to yeah. New York, and well, is pimping her out for sex. I call that human trafficking.
The reason most women do this is financial. And mostly in poor countries, they do it because it's the only
and
way they
make
money.
And often it's financial because you need drugs.
I don't
it's
think
the
so.
Only way. Yes, Bill, Jim,
Emily,
that's the way it
well,
happens.
You can call me Bill, but
no,
it's okay. Hey, Emily.
That is what happens.
How did you feel
they
in the old days in newspapers like in her neck of the woods, New Bedford and Fall River, when they used to print the pictures
I didn't like
of
it.
The Johns? Of the guys? Yeah.
I don't. I mean, because if it's a crime, they're both committing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I mean... Well, I didn't like it, and that's what I'm saying about this. This is a throwback to 40 years ago when we used to do that. Here's this minister. He's embarrassed. And he's paying for sex.
Okay. Like, oh can I say one last thing? And I had totally forgotten, and I'm embarrassed this minute. Last week, we're going to have her on the radio, too.
Who?
Good friend of mine. Former Olympic rower.
Oh,
former
Mary Mazzio.
Corporate lawyer.
Did a movie.
Now great filmmaker. Did a movie called I Am Jane Doe.
Yeah.
Where she talks to young women and
Americans.
Mostly their mothers in the United States of America.
I'm not saying it doesn't exist.
Who have been trafficked.
I'm not
and
saying
it, is not,
it doesn't exist.
Well, but if you see this film, which everybody should do, again, it's I Am Jane Doe. It's on Netflix, I think, starting... I think it just started on Netflix.
On.
I Am Jane Doe. It talks about human trafficking in the United States. And what you will come away after you watch this film, which I did,
okay.
is... Well, let me finish the thought. What you'll come away with... It is not them.
Okay.
It is
Jim,
not their kids. It is our
here's
kids.
Here's a big difference in this case. The people who set these guys up were decoys. There were no women involved.
No, that
they
is true.
Decoys.
That is true. That is
and
true.
And this was a sting.
It was a sting.
Pure
that is correct.
And simple. It was not human sexual trafficking. It was
in
a sting.
In this case, that is totally
okay,
true.
Okay, that was my point.
Okay, fine. Let's move on. Now, here is the moment, even though that was a good moment, too. Here is the moment Emily is really here for.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
It doesn't matter.
Why not? This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
It doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
Let us pray this list is not on human trafficking is all I can say.
Oh, you had to concede that last
oh,
point.
Oh, my God.
You had
okay,
to concede.
So what is it? Is it thematic?
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What is it?
So this is a list of things that you couldn't pay me to do. All right?
Okay.
And by the way, I'm not talking about shooting up heroin or skydiving or
yeah.
something dangerous
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, I don't want
that.
To
I mean,
shoot
you know,
heroin.
No. Oh, skydiving, I could be tempted if you paid me, Jim. But so these are things that I couldn't do if you paid me. Right?
Okay.
Number one, go to a Boston Calling concert. There is no amount of money.
Is that because
the
weather was so horrible?
No, I like the bands. Mumford & Sons. Yeah. You know,
I love Mumford & Sons.
Chance the Rapper.
I like these people. The experience of being crowded into a Harvard Stadium in the middle of a weekend. It's like, I just can't think of anything worse.
Okay.
Cannot think of anything.
How'd that go, anyway, this year?
I think they had good crowds. A lot of people complained there wasn't enough food
yeah.
and, or there wasn't enough access
please.
To food.
Bathrooms, yeah.
But
I ruin a good weekend.
Well, you're not forced to go. You're aware of that.
Yeah,
you
said you couldn't pay me.
Okay, fine. Next.
Couldn't pay me to go to a Kathy Griffin show. And this is before she did the thing with cutting off.
Because she offends you or you think she's unfunny?
Not funny.
Yeah, I am with you.
May I ask you a quick question about her?
Yeah.
Do you think Anderson Cooper should be doing these New Year's Eve things
with
her?
He's not doing it anymore. It's over.
I know, but when he was.
No, it was. She was grabbing his crotch.
Yeah.
It wasn't funny. That's another reason why I think CBS would be compromised, you know, putting him there.
Yeah, I thought that was bad.
Yeah.
Okay.
Couldn't pay me to buy a fidget spinner. I mean, honestly.
What? A who?
You don't know what that is?
No.
Oh, of course I do.
A fidget spinner.
I have no
this is
idea.
One of
what
the
is it?
Big crazes.
What
everybody
is it?
Has these, you know, for people with HD, whatever that is, you know, and they you haven't seen these things?
No, I've
oh,
not.
Oh, they don't think they work. Isn't there some question about whether they even work?
Boom, you know,
yeah.
A lot of kids have them.
If you have a problem with
like ADHD kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's great, Emily.
All right,
glad
Jim.
That you're not going to...
Jim,
yeah,
Jim,
God,
this one's for you.
Thank you very much.
You couldn't pay me to go out with a guy wearing a man romper.
A man romper. And I read about this just the other... Oh,
no,
the
yeah,
one-piece thing.
The rompers.
By the way, a man romper, we discussed this on the show a few weeks ago. I've got an email saying that I dishonored a pledge I made to wear a man
that's
romper
right.
on
oh,
the show
you
at the
man
library.
Romper.
However, Tori Bedford, our colleague, promised that she would find one for me. And until she does,
oh,
by
okay.
definition, I
one
can't
that
wear
fits
one.
You.
Yeah.
As soon as we find one,
all
I
right.
will be wearing
one. Continuing.
Oh, my God.
Couldn't
that would be
the day. Pay me to buy a pair of pre-ripped jeans. I don't understand that phenomenon.
Yeah.
And you see them all over this neighborhood.
You
yeah.
do.
Including
everybody.
On my daughter, who usually
yeah.
shows
pre-ripped?
Up during the pre-ripped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She
rips her own, too, but pre-ripped, yeah. Emily, yeah.
Yeah, but pre-ripped, because you pay a premium for the
hey,
pre-ripped.
Do not criticize yeah. my kid, Emily Rooney.
I think,
Emily, really.
I think they're sexy.
Here.
You know,
yeah.
I think
okay.
they think they look special.
Okay, next.
Couldn't pay me to watch an episode of The Walking Dead.
No, I'm not.
Oh, I'm with you either. There. That's gross.
That's a zombie kind of deal?
Yeah.
You been watching? Did you watch House of Cards yet?
No, no.
What do you mean, no?
I can't get into this. I can't get into any of those serial fan. I just don't have that.
Fabulous.
I know.
Music's
I heard you say
fabulous.
That.
What's the name of the guy we had on the show who does the music on House of Cards? Jeff Beal.
Oh,
the
God.
Music is as great as the show. Go ahead, next.
Couldn't pay me to do a juice cleanse.
This oh, is all the, that's ridiculous.
Have you done that, Marjorie?
No.
How about you?
I'm doing one today, actually. It's funny you should say right after the show.
You get hungry.
Finally.
Finally, thank
you. You could
God.
Not pay me to go to a water slide park. Have you ever seen one of those?
Well,
oh my God,
can I say, I don't want to get
summer.
Graphic. The problem with water slide parks
I will get
is what we all do with these little things. So I'm not doing that anymore.
Awful. Oh, I loved them. Okay. I love the one up in New Hampshire with the big Geronimo slide.
All I can think of is,
down.
You know, yeah. Germs and worse
okay,
when
fine,
I see
we
one
know.
Of those things.
Okay. So let's hope you're not doing human trafficking
I'm
on
not
the
water
beat
country.
The press.
I should do it as a rant
I wouldn't
because
if I were
of
you.
The,
Go
the
ahead.
Terminology
okay,
is not
next.
Right.
What are
it was
you
a
doing?
Sting.
What are you doing tonight? This was the sting. Watch I Am Jane Doe. Watch Mary Mazio's I Am Jane Doe and then come back next week
subject.
And talk to us.
I'm right about this one.
Okay, go ahead. Okay, what are you doing to beat the press?
Am I prostituting story from the Herald with the woman that used to pull up her shirt?
Yeah, don't tell that story.
All
go
right,
ahead.
Never mind. We are doing Scott Pelley. And then
story.
We're doing...
do you know him, by the way?
Oh, sure.
You
yeah,
do?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And what? And he is that kind of imperious
a
character?
Bit, yeah.
Okay.
You know, but he's a good guy.
Well, you would know,
yeah.
wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, you loved him.
Thank you.
You loved him as an anchor. You thought he was terrific.
I thought he was quite good, too. But what else did you do?
So this whole thing with Sean Hannity and the murder of that DNC staffer, Seth Rich, he really hasn't backed down. And even this week, you know, CBS Evening News did a piece on this last week. It's another reason I love that. Scott Pelley was there that night. And basically calling him to task. And I love that when another news organization will call out another news organization like that. And they did that. But meanwhile, Sean Hannity is continuing this boat, even though the Fox News Channel has taken down this false reporting that the guy was murdered. Over his connection to dumping those WikiLeaks documents. So
before you go, is he back on the air? Because the conventional wisdom was his vacation would be like O'Reilly. So he is back.
He is back. But, you know, I think he could go the way of Glenn Beck. He's become an embarrassment. Glenn Beck brought in really good ratings and really good money. But he became kooky. He just went off the rails.
Well, you know who has Glenn Beck on quite regularly, which actually surprises me, is Anderson Cooper, who is my favorite anchor on
I've seen
cable
that, but
television.
He's calmed down a little bit.
Hasn't Glenn Beck gone through some reformation where he's apologized for his previous lunacy?
Yeah.
But Sean Hannity, I have thought...
I don't even believe that Sean Hannity believes half the things he says anymore.
I think he is a man who doesn't have a lot of brain power.
Yeah.
I mean, the best story ever was the night that he was over... a thing we did at our old radio station where it was right at the beginning of the
Iraq War. Well, you should tell the backstory. All the hosts on our old radio station were part of a night. We were the small fries, so we went first. And it built through the stars. And the final two stars was Sean Hannity did his bit. Mm-hmm. And he was pretty good.
He was
No, he was okay. Then the last man was Bill O'Reilly. Yeah. And what did you love, Marjorie?
Well, Bill O'Reilly clearly hated Sean Hannity, probably because Bill O'Reilly was trying to get all these women and he had to sexually harass them, you know, and Sean Hannity's kind of a little cute thing with his little cowboy boots and stuff like that. So Sean Hannity finishes his talk, strolling across the stage, and Bill O'Reilly gets up there and eviscerates him.
He totally eviscerated him.
Just, like,
it was incredible.
Undermines his facts, ridicules him, humiliates him.
And he's so facile. He's so quick on his feet.
Yeah, and
he was funny, too, O'Reilly,
was funny.
Which he is not on his old show.
I'm not a big fan of Bill O'Reilly, but that night I loved him. It was absolutely great.
Emily, we'll be watching tonight.
Bye.
Nice to see you.
Okay, Emily Rooney, thank you very much. Emily Rooney joins us every week. And by the way, their ratings are down, which makes me really happy. Fox News. Yeah. Anyway, Emily Rooney joins us every week. You can keep up with her right here on WGBH for Beat the Press every Friday night at 7 o'clock. Thank you very much, Emily Rooney. Coming up, the CEO of Mother Jones is in town. We'll get her take on the good, bad, and the ugly of reporting in the era of Donald Trump. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. And we are broadcasting live from our beautiful studio here at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. We're here till 2 o'clock if you want to join us. In the aftermath of the 2016 election, Monica Bowerlin, the CEO of Mother Jones, wrote that the way to fight fake news is with real news, In February, Mother Jones was recognized for doing just that with the prestigious Magazine of the Year Award. In 2016, they published a massive investigation on private prisons. They broke the story of a veteran spy's allegations that Russia attempted to compromise Donald Trump. And to keep the momentum going, they've launched a $500,000 crowdfunding campaign to investigate Trump's ties to Russia. Monica joins us here at Boston Public Radio at the library. Monica, pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much for being here.
Likewise. It's so good to be here.
Yeah, thank you very, very, very much for coming in. So for people who do not know, tell them about Mother Jones. What is it?
It's basically public radio with the written word, is one way to think about it. We are a reader-supported news organization. We've been publishing a bi-monthly magazine for a number of years, and these days we also are, you know, 24/7 online, and the reader support is really what makes us different.
And also, people think of you rightly as you're big muckrakers. I mean, you do a lot of investigative work, which is very time-consuming.
That's the core of what we do,
yeah.
Because you really can't pay for that when you're an advertising-supported newsroom. Mother Jones was basically created to go to the places that other news organizations can't go and do the really difficult, hard stories, like the private prison investigation
yeah.
that you mentioned.
I want to talk about that in a minute, but can we talk about the beginning? It was the mid-70s, is that?
1976.
What sparked the, I don't know, what happened that caused people to get together and say, we need something like this to exist where it doesn't?
You know, I think it was actually a moment a little bit like what we're living in now, where people thought, okay, the institutions of our democracy are a little more challenged and fragile than we thought they were, and journalism is a way to keep the powerful accountable when the powerful aren't keeping themselves accountable. Post-Watergate, et cetera.
All the president's men, we were all going to be Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporters, bringing down presidents, right? That was the deal.
I have watched that movie 200,000 times.
Oh, me too. I absolutely love it, and I love seeing Carl Bernstein now on television because he's great on TV. Talking about Donald Trump, obviously.
Yeah.
So come back to this private prison thing. This was this endless, and I mean that in a loving, not a critical way, huge piece that you guys did. Tell us the gist of this, and there was response from the Obama administration.
So our reporter, Shane Bauer, went and got... He had been covering corrections for a long time, and it's really hard to figure out what goes on, especially inside these private prisons that are operated with taxpayer dollars but by private companies. They just don't give you a lot of access. And so he went and got a job. He applied under his own name and was hired as a guard and worked there for 4 months at a prison in Louisiana and saw a lot of really terrible stuff and then spent another 12 months fact-checking and reporting around it, talking to the company, asking them hundreds of questions, you know, talking to some of the people who had been inmates and guards. And then we released this really, really, really long story that a lot of people read start to finish. And the Obama administration, a few weeks later, announced that they were no longer going to do business with private prison companies.
Monica, tell people some of the things that he discovered.
One of the most interesting things for me was that he found that the guards were just as much, that this was, you know, a broken system that was breaking the guards as much as the inmates, that these were people being paid $9 an hour, constantly understaffed, constantly being asked to do things that they were not prepared to do, you know, in lots of danger and violence and sort of escalating throughout the time that he was there.
You know, we talk a lot about, before we get to the Obama reaction and the current administration's reaction, we talk a lot about prisons in general. We have Andrew Cabral in here, who was a former sheriff of Suffolk County, and you know, the things like people having to pay $14 to make a phone call, you know, per minute, and the fact that even when the non-private prisons, like the Bureau of Prisons, you can't.
It's like a rogue operation.
You can't get into these places. Just a quick example: we had a guy here, a Speaker of the House, who did a very bad thing. He took some money. He got sent to jail for 8 years. But he was, and this is a powerful politician, he felt lumps in his neck and throat, and he was not diagnosed for months because they needed him they hoped to get him to testify in a trial, and they sent him from Boston down to, where was Seldom AC, Kentucky?
Somewhere in that neighborhood,
and yeah. And there's no opportunity for reporters get in to find out what's going on or get any response from the Bureau of Prisons. It is like a rogue operation. So you get the private prisons and the public prisons that are these rogue operations.
So let's get back to the private prisons, though. So Obama took action based on your reporting, and Trump took action based on the fact that Obama took action. I mean, that is essentially what has happened already, is it not? He's undoing what Obama did on the private prison front, no?
As he is virtually, you know, it seems as if this administration is really virtually everything they do is whatever Obama did to the
opposite. By the way, her thesis, we were discussing this yesterday, we discussed it a lot, that when you look at, on the Paris Climate Accord thing, you look there, only 17% of Americans want out of it, only 22 senators out of 100, many corporate leaders, high-profile corporate leaders, want us to stay in. Everybody except Bannon and Scott Pruitt from the EPA want him to stay in. Her analysis, which sounds like it's yours, is the primary motivation.
Lots of people.
Well, but you've been voicing it for weeks now. The primary motivation is that it's Obama's thing, so it's my job to undo it. Do you subscribe to that notion, or?
I'd say the evidence fits that pattern so far. You know, yeah. It's still only a theory because we can't look inside of their heads. But, yeah. You know, when you look at two data sets that match up, it's pretty compelling.
You know, on this private prison front, well, I would argue people to read the piece if they haven't already. If you're only going to read one thing, you may not like this, but I would say don't read the piece. Read the piece that you and your colleague wrote about doing the piece, because I'm serious. No, that was not even meant as a compliment. It was meant as a real. I'll tell you why. Marjorie and I used to be on a commercial radio station. One of our colleagues, we can say his name, Michael Graham, mm-hmm. who then went to Atlanta. Now he's in Washington, working for Weekly Standard and some other things. Always would say, "We don't need the Boston Globe. You guys are always complaining about. We don't need these newspapers. We could generate these stories on the air." So what we did the next day, which we thought was very clever, is we wrote down every single story that Michael Graham did on a show, and I think he did 8 or 9 in his 4-hour show. And you know the end, of course. The answer was every single one was from the Globe or the Herald or some magazine. You did something that I think is long overdue. You wrote a long piece explaining, both financially and otherwise, exactly what went in to this reporting that mattered so much. Tell people, you don't have to go into specifics, but tell people a little bit what your goal was there and what it achieved, if anything, Monica.
Thank you so much. That really means a lot that resonated with you. It was we basically said, let's just open the books here and show people what it costs. And, you know, we did the math, and we're pretty conservative about it. And it came out to about $350,000 in staff time, you know, Shane's own time, fact checkers, editors, you know, we did videos with the story. And the ads that ran with the story online brought in about 5, you know, maybe 6 by now. And this is a story that was read by 1.5 million people. So that gap, right, that delta between the big number and the small number is where we have to figure out how we're going to save journalism.
And did people get it? I mean, I don't know what kind of response you had to all this crowdfunding stuff you're doing, but I know this was at the center of it. Did people, other than just intellectually understand what you said, but did they act based upon this exposition you did? Or?
They did. You know, it was amazing. We, as this piece that we wrote basically said, if you find this compelling and if you want this kind of journalism to exist, then consider signing up as a sustaining member for Mother Jones, just the way that many of you, you know, listening to me now, do that for public radio and public television. Because these reporters need to go down these rabbit holes day after day and month after month, and they need to be, we need to be able to sustain that over time. And I think the Trump administration is a real case in point for why.
We're talking to Monica Bowerland, who's the CEO of Mother Jones.
And as you just said, the reporter that did the prison story, 4 months in there, and then almost a year after that of that's an awful lot of time to do this investigative work. It takes forever. And sometimes you wind up not getting what you thought you might get. And so then you've sustained it for nothing. So what's your idea of a business model going forward? This sort of thing, getting people to sustain, to become sustainers of Mother Jones?
So we've had a lot of people who responded to that appeal. We just about doubled the amount of money that comes in the door from people doing that. And it's really, so overall for us, 70% of our revenue comes from readers, sometimes in the form of a magazine subscription, sometimes in the form of, you know, somebody who can give a dollar, sometimes more. And then we also bring in anything else that will work. So we do advertising. We have some support from a small number of foundations that support media. We bring in, you know, virtually every kind of revenue that's ethical and that we can combine with the integrity of a newsroom. And that, I think, is how we're going to have journalism in America.
What do you think? I mean, that's really what matters. I mean, we're thrilled that Mother Jones is succeeding with this, but the issue really is the business model replicable? We have Brian McGrory out of the Boston Globe on with us once a week, mm-hmm. and, you know, the key issue is how, I hate the word monetize, how do you monetize the online presentation of news? And I think other than the Wall Street Journal, no, or maybe the Washington Post, no one's really figured it out to make a profit yet. Is your model replicable, or is it only work for an entity like you?
I think it's going to have to be replicable not for everything. You know, there are some, I think, you know, ESPN can probably make money in other ways. But I think for news and public affairs reporting, readers supporting it are going to have to be a part of it. And you see that now with, you know, newspapers like The Times saying, support the mission of The Times.
Yeah.
It's no longer, you know, buy this newspaper.
Well, the Times and The Washington Post have gotten a pretty significant Trump bump. Their digital circulation has gone way up, even their print circulation in some cases. How about you?
Same. We got a lot of people, I think, woke up on November 9th and said, okay, you know, democracy is not on automatic pilot. I have to be part of it, and journalism is part of what I need in my democracy, and I'm going to do something about it.
You know, by the way, it always drives me crazy when people talk about the elite media, because generally speaking, the elite media is not in newspapers because the reporters are basically, you know, struggling with quarters to put money in the meter. I mean, it's so, I guess you could have the elite media would be on TV, maybe, the people that are making big bucks on CNN or CBS or something like that, but I would imagine you get a bunch of hand-to-mouth reporters because reporters don't make any money.
No, exactly.
So,
and I think, Jim, what you were saying is really interesting in terms of, you know, having the right relationship with the audience. I do think we need to stop thinking about monetizing them, which is sort of like turning them into dollar signs, and more about having a relationship that makes them feel like, yes, I want to be part of this.
We'd prefer to monetize them. In any case, we're talking to Monica Bowerlin, who is the CEO of Mother Jones. I want to talk about arguably the highest profile story you guys have broken in the last couple of years, beyond the private prison thing, the infamous 47% who are dependent on government. Was that David Corn? Is that who?
It was.
Okay. Well, I want to play the sound from this, which a lot of people heard. I'm always wondering, when someone like you gets to hear something like this for the first time, forget the finished product, but when you first get to hear this, what it feels like as a journalist, like you are. Here is, you all heard it 1,000 times, in this leaked video, Mitt Romney is speaking at a fundraiser. I think it was in Boca Raton in Florida at someone's home. Here it is.
There are 47% of the people who vote for the president no matter what. All right, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe that government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they are entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. But that's an entitlement, and the government should give it to them. And they will vote for this president no matter what. And I mean, the president starts off with 48, 49, 43. He starts off with a huge number. These are people who pay no income tax. 47% of Americans pay no income tax.
So when you heard that, when that was played for you for the first time, what did it feel? I mean, what do you say to yourself as a human and as somebody who's got the job you get? What do you say to yourself?
I mean, even now, after I've heard it, you know, 200 million times, my heart stops a little. And I think the two things that you think in that moment are, holy cow, actually, or, you know, maybe a word with one more letter. And then you go, is it real? And that's that second instinct, I think, is what makes journalism, is that you go, let's find out. Your first instinct is report against your own instincts and find out if the thing you think is real is actually real. And that's where you investigate and you verify. And it took us a long time to feel confident enough about that recording to publish it.
Was this Jimmy Carter's grandson?
The guy who recorded it was just a regular guy, a bartender who was literally working that event and thought, oh, I get to hear a presidential candidate. That's interesting.
Jimmy Carter IV
was... had made a connection between David Kwan. Yeah.
And the bartender.
At one point prior to this, there's a sort of fascinating long backstory about what we were originally investigating.
And that was one of the big turning points in the entire election. that 47% story. I mean, you guys were instrumental, obviously, in deciding that election.
It was really quite a moment.
So how long have you been at Mother Jones?
15 years.
15 years ago, how different was it in terms of worrying about these kind of problems?
It was such a different world. You know, we had 15 years ago when I started at Mother Jones, it was, you know, it was a, you know, strong little news organization, but everybody that I talked to would say, oh, Mother Jones, you know, is that still around? I used to read that in college.
Yeah.
And now it's much more, oh, Mother Jones, you're on my Facebook feed all the time. And that's, I think, you know, the advent of the way that we get our news now has really been powerful in terms of allowing people to connect with this kind of information.
So I asked you before if you got a bump in the age of Trump, as other newspapers have. How do you see yourself covering the Trump era?
I think this is, you know, not just for Mother Jones. This is for journalists everywhere. It's a sort of leave it all in the field moment, you know, where we are not even in it anymore to get this story or that story, but we're really in it as a pillar of democracy. We've got to do our job to hold the powerful accountable when they are not interested in doing that themselves.
How do you decide? I mean, I know you're raising money to help fund this Russia-Trump connection investigation thing, but I'm assuming you do what we do most days, is when Marjorie and I and our colleagues sit down to figure out what we're going to do on a show on a particular day, is while we will not avoid the big stories, we decide, can we do them a little differently? Then maybe you'll hear them somewhere else so that there is something unique that draws them to us as compared to somebody else who's doing the same story. Is that not part of the mindset at Mother Jones? It's got to be, right? When the Washington Post and the New York Times and all these other places are pursuing, the Wall Street Journal, some of the same things, how do you see yourself fitting in that sort of pantheon of responsible journalists covering the same thing that almost everybody is or pursuing the same thing? How do you define your little niche?
It's really different for us because we are not a news organization of record that you're going to turn to find mm-hmm. all the news of the day. So we very deliberately go to where we think other people aren't going. You know, it's a target-rich environment now because there's so much going on that requires investigating. So when we did, you know, you mentioned the story about the Russia memos that we published before the election, there was not really enough attention during the election campaign to that story and to the question of what might be going on with this odd behavior that the Trump campaign was exhibiting. And so we went down that road because everybody else was chasing after, you know, oh my God, Trump said something pretty wild on Twitter today. And we went after the rise of these white nationalists that was really not on the radar for a lot of people until after the election. So we constantly steer against the current.
Before you go, were you born in Germany? Is that what I read?
I was.
Is Angela Merkel the leader of the free world today after a week ago? She pauses.
For Germany to see itself as the leader of the free world is pretty fraught. So I think she would, and you know, most people in Germany would say, "Well, the last time that was, you know, on the radar was didn't work out so well." But I think she is one of the foreign leaders who are looking at the U.S. saying, "You know, we thought you guys were a beacon of certain values that we all hold dear." And, you know, we're not sure what to think.
That was a pretty bold statement from her last week. Monica, it's great to meet you. Good luck with the great Mother Jones, and thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for being here, too. Monica Borland is the CEO of Mother Jones, and thank you again for coming here. And coming up, kind of a Boston Public Library homeboy, as it were, the Boston Public Library's composer in residence joins us next. Stay tuned for that on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, broadcasting from our beautiful studio at the Boston Public Library, where a little later today we're going to have two live jugglers here. One of them says he can juggle you, Jim.
We're all anxious to see
that. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. We are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library. And speaking of the Boston Public Library, libraries were once institutions of absolute silence. Obviously, our live broadcasts here violate that code. But before we were here, Bo Kenyon came on the scene to break the sound barrier. He's the first ever composer in residence at the Boston Public Library. His residency will culminate in an upcoming performance entitled, which we'll talk about, and All the Men and Women Merely Players. That's on June 10th at 11 a.m. and June 11th at 1:30. It's a reimagining of Shakespeare's As You Like It and a live music and dance installation. It'll be staged throughout the BPL. That's really exciting. There will also be partial pop-up performances throughout the week leading up to the full performance. Bo, it's good to meet you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you do think of libraries. I don't think of libraries and having composers in residence. So what exactly do you do?
Yeah, why are you here, actually?
Why are you here? I mean,
what
are you
doing?
You
come is this
in
a review?
It's like you come a... in and sing a song in the way of the morning and sit down and play it?
I just walk around and just whistle everywhere I go. That's
exactly.
All I do.
But what does it mean to be the composer in residence here at the Boston Public Library?
Well, this is, honestly, it's a pilot program. And so that's part of what we're figuring out. And it kind of came about because I submitted two proposals to the library a little over a year ago, which is the performance that's coming up. And then also a multidisciplinary performance of music and literature that happened in the fall. And then talks with the library and about what the library stands for and, you know, injecting it with more performing arts and fine arts, thought that it would be a good fit. And so, you know, with these two performances, I'm also drawing on my background in education and curriculum development to do workshops throughout the branches where we're collecting sounds and doing some writing and doing some recording. And just delving into that.
So this is your idea?
It was a collaborative idea.
And what does multidisciplinary mean in the world in which you play?
For me, there's multidisciplinary and there's interdisciplinary. And so multidisciplinary, I think of, you know, I like working with dancers, I like working with authors and artists, and I'm working with a sculptor soon. So the idea is that we can range into interdisciplinary, where we're feeding off of each other's ideas and it's absolutely 100% connected. This one, we did some of that, but then also Michelle, who's the choreographer, she and I met and we're working from the same base material, which in this case is As You Like It, Shakespeare, and sort of feeding off of each other's ideas, but also we're occupying the same space at the same time from the same ideas.
And we should say it's the 400th anniversary. Yes, it does.
Yes,
and that's
good.
One of the reasons. You know, before you move on, though, we have a lot of people. By the way, this studio was not our idea, we should
it
say,
was
unlike
not,
you.
No.
You're lucky enough to be performing here, or whatever,
well,
we're doing
I'm,
a show here.
And but, I apologize, I want to make it clear, Michael Colford was a big part of having general idea. I didn't come to them and say,
I understand.
I should be a composer.
No, I got it. But, we have a lot of people who come through who are NPR types or commercial radio types from other parts of the country saying, why hasn't this been done before?
Right.
A radio show, a radio station, a cafe, the newsfeed cafe. What more perfect connection with the new library of 2017 rather than the old. Does anybody else have there's a purpose to this monologue of mine. Does anybody else have a composer in residence or is this a...
My understanding is that this is the first composer in residence position at any public library. That's my understanding.
So tell us about what people are going to see, because this performance is from June 5th to June 11th, according to my... Or is that correct?
That's correct.
That's correct. Okay, I just want to make sure, according to the sheet I got in front of me. So what people, what will people see when and hear and experience when they see this performance?
Great. So Monday, June 5th through Friday, June 9th, it's a partial pop-up performances. So some spaces throughout Johnson and McKim and the Courtyard... Oh, actually, excuse me. It will only be in Johnson, Monday through Friday.
Okay.
And it will be one or two musicians and one or two dancers slash actors who will be doing their bits of the overall installation. On Saturday and Sunday, everything starts at DeFerrari Hall here in the Johnson building as an initial statement of all musicians and all dancers and actors. And then for the first part, and then they'll slowly move into the courtyard. And at that point, the courtyard will happen at exactly the same time as DeFerrari Hall. So it will be a true installation. Well, they'll be going on this loop for about 35 minutes for the audience then to sort of dictate their own perspective and their own experience.
And the courtyard is this beautiful outdoor space.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
I suppose it rains.
That's a big question.
Yeah.
I have a couple of emergency backups.
Okay.
That I'm not going to talk about.
Okay.
Because I'm gonna expect that it's gonna be perfect.
Can I fawn over this? I love this idea. I think
Thank
it
you.
Is such a, it's just, and it's another one of these things. This is gonna sound like not a compliment. It's such an obvious thing that should be done in places yes. like this.
Well, you talked about people were complaining that we were making too much noise.
One
when first
woman,
got here.
One woman has
yeah.
complained
yeah.
in the months that
we've been here. Yeah,
supposed
to be library, no talking.
And I will say,
we took away your library card. By the way, I want to be clear.
No,
we
did.
No, we didn't.
Can you do that?
David Leonard, don't
heavily.
Get upset.
I call you a fascist.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well,
go
I would say that we've had a couple of sound tests with the musicians throughout the last couple of weeks, mm-hmm. just bringing them into the library, just to make sure that what I'm imagining is going to work. And to test the acoustics, and because I want to use the space. I want to make it feel as though the installation belongs here. And people were wonderful. They would stop in. I had a tendency to want to start out apologetic and like, I don't want to bother anybody. But people stopped in. They were taking pictures. They loved it. And then last night was our open rehearsal with all players. And it
so,
was beautiful.
You've been talking about what's coming up in the next couple of days. You were sent us this collage that you created off a project you did in the fall of 2016.
Correct.
We're going to listen to some of that. Describe to us what we're going to listen to.
So the fall was another multi-interdisciplinary project where I was working with an author whose name is Katrina Goldsaito. And Katrina had just recently come out with a children's book based on Toru Takemitsu, who happens to be one of my favorite 20th century Japanese composers. And I love Katrina as well. She has become a really great friend of mine, and she's amazing. And I proposed that I do a project where I wrote a piece based on her book. I had two pieces by Takemitsu. One was the harp trio, and the other one was A Bird Came Down the Walk for viola and piano. And then I also featured a piece by Marty Epstein, who was a former composer or former professor of mine and a great composer here in Boston. She teaches at Boston Conservatory in Berkeley. And so we featured her music as well. And then she also spoke a little bit about Takemitsu. And so what I did, the Takemitsu pieces were based on Emily Dickinson poetry. One of my pieces was based on Katrina's book that had just come out about Takemitsu. And my other piece was a project that I did where I would create a large-scale piece based on 100 Years of Solitude by Marquez.
Oh, yeah.
So the collage is basically Katrina reading these linearly, reading the two Emily Dickinson poems, reading the excerpt from Garcia Marquez, and then reading excerpts of her own children's book about Takemitsu. And then I layered them in a way that was deliberate and hopefully.
And that's what we're going to hear some of right
yes.
now?
Yep.
Well,
yep.
Let's do it. Let's hear it.
The classroom felt
a bird
different
came down
without
the walk.
Anyone in it.
He did not know I
he
saw.
He sat at his desk by the window.
He bit an angleworm
and pulled out a book and ate the fellow
he
rock.
Loved the story.
And then
and
the classroom
felt
red
different
from
without
from
any
convenient
grass where he was
and
by
then
the window.
Hopped sideways to the wall
he loved the
to
story.
Let the beetle pass.
Then oars divide.
He glanced
the
with
ocean.
Rapid eyes that hurried all around. They looked like frightened beads, I thought.
He stirred
his velvet head
at the edge
like
of the
one
like
rain.
But even there, the bamboo
till it curved.
I offered him a
the wind banged
and then
and
he unrolled his feathers.
That
great.
Was something. That was something. How did you become a composer?
Well, I started playing piano when I was 4.
Wow.
I'm the youngest of 3, and my older brother and sister were taking lessons, and I remember going to my parents and saying, I want to do this too. And they were great and said, sure. And so played throughout. And then when I came, I decided that I wanted to go to Berklee College of Music. So I spent 1 year at University of Iowa to do some of my gen eds, then took a year off, prepared my audition, came to Berklee was the college that I came to as a performance major in piano. But
what kind
I'd,
of kind of piano? Were you jazz or were you classical?
No, I was
or?
Primarily classical. I came to study 20th century classical, but I also wanted to go to a school like Berklee where I could get a nice breadth
yeah.
of education. So I'd had jazz piano and jazz classes, and I was in jazz band in high school, but I would not call myself a jazz pianist.
Okay.
But a lot of their theory curriculum is based on doing. So it's not just analyzing in theory, it's actually creating and composing. And I composed a little bit in high school, but I was that moody teenager who would sit at the piano and just play how I felt.
I was the movie teenager with
and
no
so
talent.
So you started writing in college.
Yes,
and more or less. And one last thing for me, you mentioned that you started playing the piano at 4. I was talking to Jim about how you see these little kids that are barely as tall as the bench playing the piano at a very early age. Uh-huh. And you teach in a Montessori school. Is it good to start your kids early in music? They seem to learn it so much more easily when they're little.
I would say music, there are some similarities to learning music and learning language. Mm-hmm. And I had done a study actually at Children's Hospital with Nadine Gobb in her in cognition and music. And so the study really was on executive function and music. And the idea that I was studying musicians and non-musicians, quote unquote, and the musicians needed to have started before the age of 7 because of certain studies that had come before.
Wow.
And so the idea is that, you know, I strongly believe that, you know, your neuroplasticity, you know, you can learn later in life and you can learn new music and learn a new language, but there's something about the sort of fearlessness and openness to learning anything new.
Before you leave, and speaking of you leaving, is there going to be a you? Is there going to be a you after you?
That's a great question. My understanding is that, and this would be more of a question for Michael Colford and the library, but my understanding is that they're going to do an every other year position. So what I'm doing, I feel the responsibility to make sure everything that I do is documented. I'm meeting with him and the rest of the team periodically to make sure that there's a very clear idea of what that next position should be. But there's a lot of opportunity here.
It's very exciting.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming. I hope everything goes spectacularly and the weather is nice.
Thank you.
Can be in the courtyard.
Thank you. I hope you guys can come.
We will.
Thank you very much.
Bo
Kenyon is the first ever composer in residence at the Boston Public Library. His residency culminates in an upcoming performance called And All the Men and Women Merely Players.
Do you know I had to memorize that whole thing? I ever told you that? All the world's a stage, all the men and women are the players.
Very
they have their
good,
exits
Jim.
And their entrances, and each man in his time plays many parts or some
yes.
such thing.
Yeah.
That was beautiful.
Well, thank you, Jim.
That was beautiful,
much
Jim.
More to it, too, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. This performance,
I'm not done.
By the way,
I'm
not
going
just
the whole
performance.
Thing right now, actually,
the performance
Marjorie.
At the library is going to be June 10th at 11 o'clock, June 11th at 1:30. It's a reimagining of Shakespeare's As You Like It in the live music and dance installation, which will be staged throughout the Boston Public Library. Also, there's going to be pop-up performances throughout the week leading up to the full performance. If you want to find out more about this, go to bpl.org. Bo Kenyon, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, we are opening up the lines to you and asking if you know how to spell Marocaine. It's our annual Spelling Bee Talker. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Library.
Welcome back. Welcome.
She's confident initially.
Marocaine.
She knows what it means.
M-A-R-O-C-A-I-N.
That is correct.
Congratulations.
This is Boston Public Radio. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. That, of course, was the $40,000 word that I just spoke over. 12-year-old, I hope I get her name right, Ananya Vinay. She's from California. She won the Scripps National Spelling Bee yesterday and the $40,000. This means, of course, that it's time for our annual edition of So You Think You Can Spell. Our number is 877-301-8097. It's a low-stakes, no-prize-money fun. Test your spelling skills right here. We're going to give you actual words. We're not sure we can pronounce them well. Actual words and their definition from yesterday's spelling bee, and we'll see if you can do that. And by the way, just to humor me, because as I said yesterday on the air, I think these spelling things are sadistic. I really do. They're just, when you see how the kids train, I hate it. In any case, if you want to comment on that, too, do you think they put too much pressure on young kids? Do you think it's admirable that spelling and an appreciation of language is so esteemed? 877-301-8970. And if you don't think it's too much pressure on a kid, we play, I don't know if it's from last year or not, there's this really confident little boy. Do you remember this?
Oh, gosh, the kid that was crying.
He wasn't crying. He's in a spelling bee. A lot of them cry. He fails to spell a word that I can't pronounce. Listen to this kid and tell me this is not too much pressure for a young boy or girl. Here it is.
Kabaragoya.
Kabaragoya. I know it. I know it. I totally know it. Okay. Kabaragoya. C-A-B-A-R-A-G-O-Y-A. Kabaragoya. What?
Kabaragoya is spelled K-A-B-A-R-A-G-O-Y-A.
That kid is never going to be the same. I'm telling you right now. I don't know him. I wish him well. That is an incredibly painful kind of thing. And even if you get him right, it's just, it's too much. So we're going to try to do it with a little more, what's the word I'm looking for? Levity, freedom, ease, that kind of thing. Our number is 877-301-8970. And by the way, we're going to do, in addition to taking phone calls, we have, I don't even know what it's called, library mic, whatever this thing is.
Homie
sitting
mic.
Over here. There's Tina, our colleague. Christina, raise your hand, Christina. Thank you very much. If anybody wants to take the spell test with us, participate in the spelling bee, you walk up to Christina, she'll put you in line, and you can participate in this, too. What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say we have a little gimmick. Where this,
it's not a gimmick.
About which words are most
it's an add-on.
looked up because they're misspelled in certain states.
So explain what we're going to do with that, Marjorie.
Well, we're going to ask people where they came from. A lot of people here probably came from Massachusetts.
They might have, yes.
But they'll quickly dispense with the word that Massachusetts is most upset about spelling. I can't even read the word Massachusetts is so upset about spelling.
Don't say what it is.
Do you know what it is? Is that long word from Mary Poppins?
No, it is not. Okay. But can I just say one thing, just to explain how this is going to work? You're going to get a word from the actual spelling bee to start with. And then if you want to comment on whether or not you think these bees are sadistic, you can do that too. And then we're going to do what Marjorie said is sort of the bonus round for each of you. We'll ask you your home state or your parents' home state or something.
Or some state you'd like to live in.
And Google Trends put out what is the single most misspelled word, I guess on Google, from particular states, and we'll ask you about that.
Yeah,
too.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
It is pretty good.
Our number is 877-301-8970. The email is bpr@wgbh.org. If you want to, well, yeah, I guess you can't really do it on the email, can you? You can't participate in the email, but you can certainly participate on the phone if you want to get involved in the spelling
bee. And by the way, can I tell you what's going to happen in a second?
You're hysterical about these spelling bees. What? It's no different than kids striking out in Little League.
Which
is traumatic,
that's
too.
That's traumatic, too.
What are you going to do? Just not play sports and not spell? Or
sit on the couch, eat Cheetos until you're 18.
You could be the last kid picked in Red Rover. You know what I mean?
No, I'm telling you. Have you seen any of the documentaries on this spelling stuff? Well, it is really inspiring that some of these kids are this smart. Mm-hmm. It is like torture. Training is torture. Memorizing the dictionary is not a normal behavior.
But maybe some of them want to excel at something, and they've chosen spelling. What's wrong with
that? They want to excel at masochism. That's what they want to excel. Now, by the way, what's going to happen when we start the quiz is Marjorie is going to say on the air, oops, I can't find my words. Is that what you're going to say? Do you have any idea where the words are you're supposed to be?
I think we're doing the memorable words from the National Spelling Bee,
correct?
Oh, my God,
you do have it. Okay, let's start this thing. Mary in Framingham, you're the first participant in the Boston Public Radio Spelling Bee. Welcome to the show. How are you, Mary?
Oh, thank you. I love you guys, and I'm totally open to public humiliation.
Well, here you go.
You be ready, because I never heard of this word. I would have no idea how to spell it.
And in my mind, I misspelled the word that you played of the little girl saying, what
fabulous.
Was it, Marcone?
Well, we're really glad to hear that.
I was misspelling it.
Okay, I'm going to say this phonetically. You ready?
All right.
Maram. I'll define it.
Please.
It's a Scandinavian-derived word for a beach grass.
Of course.
Yes. One of the
for a beach what?
For a beach grass.
Yes.
A previous contestant in the spelling bee misspelled it as Marem, M-A-R-E-M. So that's not how you spell it. Opening the door for this little Anyana Vigne's victory.
Okay, how do you spell
Marem? And can you pronounce it again in your phonetic spelling?
Marem.
Pronunciation.
Marem. Yes.
Mary, this is not like the SATs. You get it wrong, nothing bad happens. Just do it, okay?
Marem.
How do you spell Marem?
Marem. I will guess that it's M-E-R-R-A-M.
Well, you will guess wrong. Thank you.
You were close, though.
No, she was not close.
Yes, she was. She only had one letter off.
How do you spell it?
It's M-A-R-R-A-M. But you were very close, Mary. Congratulations.
Okay, Mary, congratulations for getting it wrong.
Glad to participate.
Don't go away. Mary, what state are you from? What state are you from?
Actually, Jim, I'm from Philly. And I listened to your Wawa rants a lot. And I'm going there this weekend for graduations for family. Wow. And I thought I should come back and send Marjorie a Wawa cup.
You know what you should do? You should stop by the studio and Jim can write you a check to pay them back at the Wawa.
Okay,
Supermarket.
Fine. Forget that.
I think he owes him some money.
Since you're from Pennsylvania, Mary, before you go away, the single most commonly misspelled word on Google search thing here is sour.
I can more tell you all of the mispronounced
words. I'm going to tell you what the word is, and you're going to spell it.
This is a hard one.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
Sauerkraut. How do you spell sauerkraut there, Mary?
S-A-U-E-R-K-R-A-U-T.
Very
you are
good.
Excellent. Nice work there, Mary. Thank you very much. You did very well. Mary, good luck in Pennsylvania.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Our next contestant is John from Providence. Hi, John.
Hi, John.
Hello.
John, do you think spelling bees are sadistic, yes or no?
No, they're not.
Watching a spelling bee is sadistic.
Well, that is also true.
It's true. That's true, because you're rooting for the kid, and you don't want the kid that looks like they might be too insecure to misspell their name. But look at these kids. These kids have gotten to the championship round. They probably defeated thousands of kids by now.
How about the kids who lose?
Well, so you come in 10 for 20. Jim, do you want to give her, does everybody have to have a trophy?
No, I don't believe in that either.
You do believe in that.
No, I don't.
You're essentially saying this is too cruel, because you know why somebody wins and somebody loses.
That's exactly
That's how it works.
That's right.
In sports and in life and in spelling
bees. Okay,
fine. You ready, John, for the
word? John, here's your word.
Okay, go ahead, Jim.
Ways.
Lay it on me.
Ways goose. It's a word, of course, of unknown origin, John, meaning a printer's annual outing or entertainment, whatever that means. Ananya Vinay, who won, spelled it correctly during her duel for the title with Rohan Rajiv. Ways goose is the, whatever it is the word there, John. Take it away.
Ways goose.
Mm-hmm.
W-E-Y-S-G-O-U-Z-E.
By the way, you could not have been farther off if you tried to get it wrong. Excellent work.
Okay.
How's it spelled, Marjorie?
It is spelled W-A-Y-Z-G-O-O-S-E. But you were close, John.
That was horrible, John.
I had a Z in there, at least.
Do you want to get, tell us what state you're from?
I'm originally from Iowa.
Perfect.
Iowa. Oh, my God.
Marjorie doesn't know which state is Iowa.
I'm going to
have
to find Iowa on the map.
Do you know which one it is?
I think it is, yes. I think
I've got it. What's the word? What's the most misspelled word on Google in Iowa?
I think it's vacuum.
It is. How do you spell vacuum, John?
V-A-C-U-U-M.
Wow. That is correct.
You are a hell of an Iowan. Thank you.
So all these people that are looking to see what was how to spell these words on Google search, that's pretty bad that everybody was looking up the word vacuum, don't you think?
Well, what else do you do in Iowa, I guess?
Were they looking up the word vacuum? Were they writing about vacuum cleaners?
I don't know, Marjorie, I don't know.
How many times do you write a story about a vacuum cleaner?
How many times do you write a story about a vacuum cleaner?
Well, I can't recall ever having to deal with writing about vacuum cleaners in my long career.
Did you ever
writing stories.
You didn't like? Did you see the movie Once, which is one of my favorite movies
Absolutely.
Of all time? Did you like it? I can't remember. You didn't like it.
I loved it.
Well, there's a great scene with the woman leader dragging her in need of repair vacuum cleaner through the streets of was it Dublin?
Jim, that
where
does
it was?
Not explain why the word vacuum is so often Googled.
It's the
in
biggest
Iowa,
word
does it?
In Iowa.
All right, number
caucus
877
and vacuum are the two words.
Yeah.
They can't spell caucus either. Trust me.
877-301-8970. If you want to participate in our spelling bee in honor of the annual national
Wait
spelling
a second.
Bee,
there's nobody from the library who wants to participate in the spelling bee. No one has enough courage. Come on. Somebody has got to come up to Christina
well,
and the mic.
Well, because these words are too bizarre.
Are you coming up to do this? About time. Who are you, by the way?
My name's Laura.
Laura. Are you nervous?
A little.
Not as nervous as I am, Laura.
All right. Here's another ridiculous word,
Wait a second. Where are you from, first of all, Laura?
I live in Charlestown, but I'm from Rhode Island originally.
Perfect.
Oh, Rhode Island.
Both
great things.
Oh, we'll
have to give you the special Rhode Island word.
Well, let's give her the word
minutes.
From the quiz, from the spelling bee
oh,
first.
Oh, the Rhode Island word is a pretty easy one.
Well, let's get to the spelling bee first.
That doesn't speak well of Rhode Island. Everybody's looking at how to spell this. Okay, this is a hard word, but I'm going to say it phonetically, and then I'll give you the definition.
Yes, you are.
The word is Struldbrug. And it is coined by Jonathan Swift in his novel Gulliver's Travels. It means one of a class of imaginary persons who can never die but are declared dead in
sure
law
does.
At the age of 80
Struldberg.
And live on Berg. Wretchedly at state expense. Okay, here's the word again, Struldbrug.
Have you ever used that in a sentence? Tell the truth.
Yes.
Totally. You have. Excellent. Okay.
All right,
okay.
Struldberg.
Brug. No, you got
Brug.
A long Struldbrug.
Brug. Yeah.
Exactly.
S-T-R-O-U.
Oh, my God.
No. G-H-L-B.
Try to start again, because you seem like a nice person. Start all over again. Go ahead.
I just gave a final today. I'm a teacher, so
you are?
This is probably payback.
What do you teach? Okay. Not English.
Physics.
Oh, that's
physics.
Okay. Okay, fine.
Struldbrug.
Try it again.
Struldbrug.
Yes.
Do it slowly.
S-T-R-U.
Mm-hmm. Whoa.
H.
No. Say L.
L.
L. Good. Next.
Brug. B.
No. D.
Oh,
D. Say D.
Oh, God.
Then take Brug. Say Brug.
Brug.
Good. Spell that.
B. R. U. G.
Yes, that excellent. That was terrific.
Okay, we have our first winner right here at the Holy Mind.
Well, I wouldn't say she was exactly
a
winner.
I don't know if I was a winner. I was a C.
Well, that's okay. That was all right.
And you're from Rhode Island.
Yeah.
This part, what's the Rhode Island word? What's the most misspelled word?
I think the Rhode Island word is liar.
No,
liar.
It cannot be.
Yes.
It is. That
it
is really
liar.
Pathetic.
That does not speak well of the ocean that. State. Okay, how do you spell liar? Pressure's on.
L-I-A-R?
That is correct.
Okay.
Thank God you
represent. What grade physics do you teach before you go away?
All 9 through 12.
And what do you say to a ninth grader who says, physics will have absolutely nothing to do what I intend to be to do with my life? What do you say to that?
I say this a lot. Mm. And I talk about the physics that we see every day and to make them informed citizens, obviously, in the world we're living. So
now, one last question before you go.
I'm not done with her either, actually.
Do you think that spelling bees are cruel and unusual punishment for these children, or do you think that a lot of them want to take a chance and excel at spelling?
I think some of the kids are totally just into it,
yeah.
And it's something for them to focus on. I personally think maybe the words are too hard, but
so do I.
Okay, now here's what we're going to do.
They're ridiculous words.
We want to see if you learned anything today in your brief encounter with us.
Okay.
How do you spell Struldbrug?
Oh, man. S-T-R-U-D.
No.
No, L-D.
Yeah.
Very good.
B-R-U-G.
Yes, woo! Very nicely
all
done.
Right. Very nicely done.
I'd like to be one of your students. Thank you very much. That was actually fairly impressive. She was relatively close. What we're doing, by the way, is the sadistic Scripps
so
National
sadistic.
Spelling Bee concluded yesterday. A little 12-year-old kid, Ananya Vinay from California, won $40,000. And what we do every year on Boston Public Radio, I think we did it in our former lives in commercial radio too, I'm not sure, is we give you the words that they were asked to spell and see if you can do
that's
them.
Right. And the words they're asked to spell are absolutely ridiculous words. I mean, no one's ever heard of them. No one's ever going
to use
them.
Well, see, that's another thing. Can you speak to that? That's what the teacher just said a minute ago. What is the value of a 12-year-old, well, how old is this kid? 12 years old.
Right.
Knowing how to spell Struldbrug.
Well, there is no value, but these are the end game words. I mean, we should start out with the words. Next year when we do it, we'll start out with the words
that start out
with the beginning.
No, we won't.
Because they're more normal words at the beginning, and they have to get these really difficult words to stump these kids. Okay, we're going to try now with Julie in Holliston. Thank you for calling, Julie.
Hi, Julie.
Hello.
How are you feeling about this, Julie?
I'm doing all right. I'm ready.
Okay.
Oh, good.
This is another ridiculous word that I'd never heard of, but nonetheless, here's the word. Boo Mickey.
Boo Mickey.
Yes. It is a mixture of cement and powdered stone used for filling crevices. I just used it yesterday.
Okay. That's it. Boo Mickey.
That's right. That's the word. Do you want to give it a shot?
Sure. Boo Mickey?
Yes.
That's the word?
That
okay.
is still the word.
Did I pronounce it right?
Yeah. How the hell would I know? Boo Mickey. Gosh. Yeah, you pronounce it right. Oh, no, it's Boo Mickey.
It could be Boo Mickey.
Whatever it is. Spell the word, will you, Julie?
Okay. B.
That's good.
Good start.
U.
U.
M.
Yes.
Ooh.
I.
Yes.
Yes.
C-H.
Oh, you were
really
close.
It's B-U-M-I-C-K-Y.
But that was thrilling, let me tell you, because you're so close.
Suspense.
Now, Julie, where were you born?
I was born in New York.
Oh, well, good. That's another state. Okay, let's do New York.
That is another state, Jim.
It is. I just said, this is pathetic. How, I think, can these people be any dumber?
I tell you, this shows the contrast. This is the most frequently Googled words of how to spell them. So this means that a lot of people in New York State do not know how to spell this word. We're going to give you your opportunity to redeem your state, Julie. The word is beautiful.
That's pathetic. Go ahead, Julie.
B-E-A-U-T-I-F-U-L.
Can I tell you, that was really Boo Mickey. It really was. Julie, thank you very much for the call. Wait, we have another library contestant? Oh, this is why we're here.
Oh, gosh.
Get over here.
Okay.
I don't mean get over here. I mean, please join us, if you will. Now, what is your name again?
Barry.
And you're not really from Indiana.
Yes.
Why are you here, then?
Work for the past couple years.
So you're here, but you're from Indiana. Got it. Okay. Now, Barry, what's your confidence level?
For spelling?
Yeah.
F7.
Oh,
okay. It's not bad.
Okay, Marjorie, give Barry from Indiana his word here, please.
Okay, this is another crazy word.
No, it's not.
Corriedale.
Corriedale berry.
It is a large hornless sheep from New Zealand.
Yep.
The word, that's
whatever.
The word. I'm not going to go into all this detail.
Okay.
Corriedale. That is the word.
Don't
large
look at Christina.
Sheep.
Just answer the question. Do you want a lifeline to somebody? What's the deal?
Well, does it start with a Q?
Well, that's a hell of a start. No.
No.
Start it again. Why don't we tell you this? It starts with a C. Corriedale.
Corriedale. C-O-R-R-I-E-D-A-L-E.
Ho!
Whoa. That was really
now,
all right. impressive.
We're not done with you, Barry. How is Mike Pence as governor of Indiana?
As governor? I haven't lived there for a while, so I can't really talk about
it. In other words,
that.
You don't want to talk about it.
I can tell you. He's terrible.
Okay. Now,
if I had a choice.
Okay, that's
Indiana's got a tougher word, though, because I think there's a lot of confusion about spelling this word.
No, I don't think so.
You ready?
Okay, you ready for this?
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah. H-A-L-L-A-E-U.
Who? Start again.
H-A-L-L-A-E-A-U.
No.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think a lot of people misspell, and there's also this hallelujah that starts with an A.
Why would
hallelujah,
you want
hallelujah.
To spell it in Indiana? You know?
It's H-A-L-L-E-L-U-J-A-H.
Nothing to say about Indiana.
Barry, it's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Pleasure to meet you.
That's right.
Thank you so much.
That's right.
For
that's
joining. Let's hear for Barry in the library. And
thank
by the
you.
Way, we're going to do this for a few more minutes. If a few of you could exhibit the same level of courage as your fellow library goers, we'd much appreciate that. 877-301-8970. Where do you want to go next, Margaret?
We're going to go back to the phones. Let's
yes,
go to Josh in Rhode Island.
Hi, Josh.
Hi, how y'all doing?
Great.
Hello?
Are you? We're here.
Good.
Okay. This is a gettable
now,
one.
This is one you should be able to get. Josh,
the only one I could have spelled so far,
feel terrible
by the way.
If you don't get it. Auteur.
I like gettable ones.
Okay,
ready?
Good.
Auteur.
Mm-hmm.
It means author, right?
Yeah, it's A-U-T-E-U-R.
Whoa.
Very
you just went,
good.
How about a ding, ding, ding for this
very
guy?
Good.
Thank you very much. Now, unfortunately, since you're Rhode Island, and we already did Rhode Island, you can't spell liar
well,
for
I'm
us.
From California.
Perfect.
Okay.
By the way, it's the same word as
it's the same word we already used.
Whatever in New York.
That was in New
What's
York.
What's your favorite state?
B-A-U-T-I-F-U-L.
No, forget that. What's your favorite state that you're not from?
Hook'em Horns, Texas.
Texas, perfect.
Okay.
How do you
Texas.
Spell maintenance?
Maintenance.
Actually, he's going to get this. He got auteur. How do you spell maintenance, Josh? Get with it here. Come on.
M-A-I-N-T-E-N-A-N-C-E, maintenance.
You
That's
are
beautiful.
Correct.
Josh.
You are correct.
So, Josh,
You're
you sound
impressive.
Like the kind of person who would agree with me that these tests are sadistic. Yes or no? What do you think?
I think national competitions for children are sadistic.
That is exactly right. Excuse me. Don't go away. Marjorie, do you like those little beauty contests for little kids nationally? I'm
no.
so glad he said the national thing.
No.
So why is that not okay? This is okay because it's a brain power thing?
Because it's showing a skill that they
it's
that they
memorization.
Really hard
What's
these,
the skill?
They memorize these words. And they can say, that in the spelling bee, they say the origin is German or the origin is Latin or it's Greek. And it helps you understand how words are put together and helps you with languages. I mean, it is... You know, I don't think they need to have $200 an hour tutors.
Which they do.
Which they do for some of these
Josh,
kids.
Josh, thank you. You were excellent.
This little girl has her education paid for. They put that $40,000 in the bank.
Yeah, you know what she's going to use the $40,000 for? Therapy. She's going to use it for after studying for this test. You the next one or what? Okay. You don't look as confident as Barry looked, are you? Your name is Andrew, by the way. Do you know that?
Yes, I do.
Okay, fine. So that's a good start.
I can't even pronounce this one. Never mind.
Okay, then I'll take it away.
You do it.
So, Andrew, how are you feeling about this?
Not that great.
Good. It's perfect.
This
That's
is a hard
glad
word.
Here.
This is a terrible word.
Now, I'm going to read the definition first because I'm not even sure I can pronounce it. So that's not a good start. It's means composed of or adorned with gold or ivory. You with me so far?
Okay, yep.
Thank you, Andrew. Here's the word. Chryselephantine. Let me try it again. Can anybody pronounce this word in the library or no? Does anyone know what the word is? No, nobody does. Okay. Chryselephantine, I believe, is the word. And this is so horrible. If you get this one wrong, we may give you another one. Go ahead. Take it away.
Chryselephantine?
Actually, I think that is... Fantine.
Fantine.
Chryselephantine, yeah.
Yeah.
It obviously means composed of or adorned with gold or ivory.
Everyone knows that.
Okay, go ahead. Take it away, Andrew.
C-R-I-S... Can you repeat it?
No. Chris Elefantine. Yeah, first of all, half the letters are wrong so far, but just keep going. Say anything just to get through this if you want. Go ahead.
C-R-I-S-F-L-A-T-I-N-E.
Okay, fine. Let's not even tell them what the right answer is.
You know what?
What?
It might have been Churis Elefantine.
Well, whatever it was. Now, you're...
In that case, I would have gotten it right, obviously.
Yeah, C-H-R-Y-S-E-L.
You're one of the younger contestants so far. Do you see any... So you're an appropriate person. Is there any value in a 12-year-old... You're well beyond 12, but you were 12. Is there any value at all in a 12-year-old memorizing and learning how to spell Chris Elefantine, meaning composed of or adorned with gold or ivory? Let's hear it.
I think there definitely is some value in any sort of competitive endeavor as long as there's the right focus on it for the kids. Not being so much about do you actually win the national competition, but what skills do you learn along the way?
Exactly.
How do you learn to deal with failure? Just like a sport, really.
Exactly.
That is very grown up.
He's absolutely right.
That is very mature.
He's absolutely right. And when that ridiculous word, Chris Elefantine, however you say it, they would tell you in that story that it was from the Greek, because that would help you with the Greek root Chris, like C-H-R-Y-S.
Now, you're originally from Maine. Is that correct,
Andrew? Which means gold, of course.
Okay, here's the word. What's the word from Maine, Marjorie? Let's get with it here.
The word from Maine is, Felimonia?
Pneumonia.
Pneumonia. I couldn't read it. Thank you.
By the way, some people in Maine call it Felimonia. So if you want to spell that, it's fine. But most people call it pneumonia.
Pneumonia.
Is that correct? Take it away, Andrew.
P-N... E-U-M-O-N-I-A.
Excellent.
Very nicely done.
Very
Let's hear
good.
It for Andrew, yet
great.
Another courageous contestant. Now, the very bad news is we only have a few more minutes to continue with this because we've got to move on to our juggling quiz.
Yeah, we do.
In a couple of seconds. So let me ask you, Marjorie, look at the sheet. I would like you
I'm not
to spell.
I'm going to spell a word.
I'd like you to spell.
I don't know how to spell it.
Whirlicoat. Excuse me, I'm asking a question.
Yeah.
A heavy and luxurious carriage or coach. Whirlicoat. Go ahead.
Whirlicoat?
I said it. Whirlicoat, yes.
I have no idea, but
I will try.
Okay, W-I-R-L. Whirlicoat?
I said that, yes.
A-C-O-T-T.
Oh, my God. That was just
okay, what
atrocious.
Was it?
Atrocious. W-H-I-R-L-I-C-O-T. Why don't you give me one?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Here we go, Jim.
Give me Chris Elefantine.
No.
Go ahead. No, really.
How about... Skeuomorph,
exactly.
An ornament or design representing a utensil or implement. Did you cheat and look
no,
at this?
No, I did not. Repeat it one time, please, and give me the definition a second time, if you would.
Skeuomorph. An ornament or design representing a utensil or implement.
And I will repeat the word before I spell it correctly.
Okay.
Skluenmorph. Is that what it is?
Skeuomorph.
Skeuomorph, as I was saying a minute ago.
Okay,
that, of course, is skeuomorph. It's S-Q... U-E-L-M-O-R-T-F.
You're only off by seven
How letters. Close was I?
Thank you. S-K-E-U-O-R. Morph,
M-O-R-P-H. Give
very
it to me.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Very good. That was wonderful,
By the
Jim.
Way, if you didn't know, that was an ornament or design representing a utensil or implement.
No, I use one every day.
Okay,
with
we
my
only
tea.
Have time for two more contestants.
Okay, Marcia from Newbury, you are the final contestant.
No, you're not. You're second
whoops,
to final.
You're final. I'm sorry, Marcia, you're not the final. It's okay. Zane from Warren, Rhode Island. We have a lot of Rhode Islanders calling us today.
Marcia, you're on. How are you, Marcia?
Hi, great. Thanks, you guys. Hey, wait, I have a really funny story about spelling bee.
Oh, go ahead. Let's hear it.
So when I, at the end of eighth grade, I went to the Elton John concert in Foxborough, all the way from northern Maine.
Okay.
With the Maine spelling bee champion. And
really?
And corrupted her, taught her the joys of Strawberry Hill wine. But she was the Maine spelling bee champ. So that's my story.
That is an incredible story, I should say.
Thank you very much
now,
for that story, Marcia.
Was there any osmosis thing happening? Can you spell or can you not?
I try, you know. I'm not one of those. I really get annoyed when people spell your house, Y-O-U-R.
What are you saying?
Kidding.
But that is how you spell your house.
I know, that was a joke.
It was an excellent joke. My apologies. What's the word for Marcia from Newbury, please, Marjorie?
Okay. Sabrins.
Mm-hmm. What is it?
A hard cheese suitable for grating.
Sabrins.
You ready?
All right.
This is gettable, too, actually, Marcia.
It is not. It's hard.
Oh, yes, it is. Go ahead, Marcia.
S-A-B-R-I-N-S.
NES.
No.
Well, you were close.
No, this is
it's
bad.
SB as in boy, RINZ. But Marcia, thank you anyway.
No, we're not done with
we're
her.
Not. Oh, what, you were from.
Where are you from again?
What state are you from?
Oh, I'm from Maine. I know how to spell pneumonia.
Well, we're not asking about
well, we
pneumonia.
We already done that.
Let's assume, for argument's right. sake, that you are from. Where is she here?
Massachusetts.
I have a good one, actually. What's the state north of Louisiana? I'm not sure what that state is. What is that state, Marjorie?
Alabama.
That would be Arkansas. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Arkansas.
If you
okay.
were from Arkansas, we would ask you to spell. Chihuahua. Could you please spell Chihuahua for us, Marcia from Newbury, please?
Oh, really? That is tough.
Why don't you call your friend from Maine from the Elton John concert? See if
I know. Can you hold for
here,
a second?
Exactly. Spell Chihuahua. Come on, get with it here.
I think it's like, let me just sort of, okay, C-H,
This is hard.
I-U,
no.
Wawa.
That's good enough. That's fine. Yes, that's correct. Marcia, thank you very much for participating. In the quiz here. We're going to squeeze one last in 30 seconds. You only get one word. Zane from Warren, Rhode Island.
Hi, Zane.
Zane, you got to be fast here.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Excellent.
We're very good.
Here's a question. It's an alliance of French political parties formed during an election, and the word is... What is the word?
Apparentement.
Yeah, that's what it is. An alliance of French political parties. Yeah,
yes,
formed
it's a
during
French
an election.
Word.
What is it? How do you spell it, I mean?
A P A R T E N T A M O N T E.
Sure, that's fine. Thank you very Zane, thank you very much for participating.
In
and
case
thank
you want to know, Zane.
And thank you all the library for
A-P-P-A-R-E-N-T-E-M-E-N-T.
Participating.
A P P A R E N T E M E N T. Okay, we are moving on
thank
to
God
our
we're done with
Friday
that.
News quiz. We're bringing street performance indoors
yes,
with Jenny
are.
The
First
Juggler
ever,
and
think.
Peter Panic. They're going to juggle live right here at the Boston Public
and
Library.
And take the quiz.
And take the quiz, and maybe they'll juggle Jim. They're next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, and we are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And if you're not here already, you should get here fast. We are live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us, I don't think we've ever done this before, for our Friday news quiz, are Jennifer Oberhauser, a.k.a. Jenny the Juggler, Boston's best and only female professional juggler. We met you when you called in a couple of months ago. It's great to meet you, Jenny. Thanks so much for being here. And Peter McLaughlin, a.k.a. Peter Panic. I'm guessing you've seen him perform at Harvard Square or Faneuil Hall. Peter, it's great to meet you, too. So is this, you would know, we believe this is the first ever live performance of juggling on a radio show. Is that?
Peter?
I've done it before.
You have not, Peter.
Really?
I did it on Kiss 108 one time.
With Maddie Siegel or
with
something?
With Maddie in the Morning.
Oh, my God.
I didn't
want
to bring up his name. But
that's
well, we
okay.
Love Maddie.
We love
He's
Maddie.
One of our favorite people. We
So you juggled with Maddie in the studio?
He had a remote broadcast from a bowling alley.
Oh, perfect.
And so he had a studio audience like this one. They can't see me. But he wanted us to juggle bowling balls. So me and a friend did that.
Now, Peter, as he was speaking, was juggling. Bowling pins, exactly. Now, I know this is not quite as luxurious as
it's
a bowling alley, but it is.
Here's the joke. I'm juggling.
Ah!
I'm on the radio.
That's a
yeah,
good
that's
one,
very
Peter
good.
Thing.
Did Maddie have the minicam to do this or not?
This was the mid-'80s.
Oh, the mid-'80s.
Mid-'90s,
actually. Mid-'90s, so
the
no
90s.
Minicam. Okay.
They didn't have television yet.
No
TV. Okay. Well, that was very impressive. And you're juggling, I should point out, with the headset on, which makes it a little bit more challenging, correct?
Right, because I'm tethered to a cord here.
You are tethered to a cord.
I need to move my body, so we'll do the best we can.
Have you ever done this on the radio?
Not on the radio,
oh,
no.
Oh, great. Terrific.
This is my Cinderella moment, you know. I went from caller to guest.
That's amazing.
So, that is true.
I hope you live up to expectations.
You have your slippers on. You can leave one as you run out the door.
Sure.
Now, you were holding three soccer balls. Is that correct?
I am.
Now, do you want to do a little,
sure.
just a little starting with this? Now, Jenny
Woo!
Is juggling as she is speaking to us. Is it hard? Whoa. And
whoa.
Peter is juggling. Whoa,
Woo!
Yes.
Woo!
Now, is it hard to talk and think while you're juggling, or do you have to just focus right on what you're doing there?
At this point, no. That's the job.
It is the job.
For me, I don't know about you, but for me, the juggling is secondary to the connection with the audience.
You were juggling all the time. You're talking.
Right, and I'm looking you in the eye.
Yeah, looking me in the eye, which is very impressive.
So when I'm performing, I'm looking at the audience. Yeah.
So before we start this quiz, Peter, with you first, every single kid I know, including myself, and I'm assuming Marjorie, tried to juggle and wanted to be able to juggle. Some of us don't become professional jugglers. A few of you do. What's the difference between you and me? How did you end up doing this thing?
You know, as a kid, you're told you can be anything when you grow up. And I decided that I was going to take that seriously. And you get to pick something. And this
you pick
is what
juggling?
I picked juggling. You can do the joke.
Wow, I didn't even mean it as a joke.
No,
I
but
mean, that's
that
amazing.
I started when I was still young enough to believe that you really can follow that American dream. A guy named Steve Allen started as a vaudeville juggler. Do you know that name?
Steve Allen from Tonight Show?
Steve Allen, yeah.
Oh, wow.
He
did
he was a radio star and a TV star, but he was a vaudeville juggler.
One of the cleverest, funniest men, in addition to everything else, in the history of entertainment, by the way.
Also, W.C. Fields was well known to be.
He was?
He was a vaudeville juggler.
He probably juggled little kids. How did you get started in this
And
field?
I want to add to that, not in vaudeville, but Steve Martin also, one of my...
Steve Martin.
My idols also started as a juggler.
I didn't know
and
that.
And magician. He was
and
a
magician.
Right.
Well, my story is actually... has to do with Peter, so I'm happy to have him here today. Because it was 20 years ago, I was finishing my college degree, and I was in Harvard Square a lot, and I was a fan of the arts in general. And his show and his wit in particular... His skill and wit in particular just alighted my imagination. And, you know, long story short, the course of my life changed, and I ended up leaving my job and traveling and coming back and becoming a juggler. Our other friend recommended I start in a show. I got in a show and traveled with that, so that was like boot camp training for me to become a performer. And then I left that show to pursue my solo career, which... I intend to continue pursuing indefinitely.
Wait, Jenny, the juggler, you didn't juggle until you saw Peter doing it?
I learned to juggle from a book when I was 12 years old. This famous book.
Like you did, probably.
This famous book called Juggling for the Complete Klutz. The Klutz has become a huge industry since then in every type of hobby.
Yeah.
My big brother went away to college, and I didn't have anybody to bother anymore, so I picked up the stuff he left behind and learned to juggle. Did never think about it till my mid to late 20s. When I started hanging out with AKA the wrong crowd and
pointing to Peter, by the way, I should say, as she's
and I never went back.
Is that when you learned to juggle, was juggling for a klutz around then, or did you just learn by yourself?
I learned from that book too.
You learned from that book too.
That book turned on a whole generation. It came out in the late 70s into the 80s. There's an organization called the IJA, and back
International Jugglers Association.
The International Jugglers Association, they have conventions, but in the 90s, there really was a thriving street performing scene in Harvard Square. It's not the same anymore. They're still down at Faneuil Hall some of the time. But it was a different time sort of before the digital world where people weren't focused on their screens.
Yeah, in their
they were
screens.
Looking up.
So when you first start to juggle, is there a go-to thing you should start juggling? Is it balls?
You start
like
with
that?
Balls.
You start with balls. Big balls, little balls, doesn't matter?
Little beanbag.
Baseballs.
Beanbags.
Beanbag, orange, or baseball's good.
Huh.
Lacrosse balls, but yeah, like a
beanbag is good because when it drops, it won't roll away too far.
Oh.
A tennis ball is bad because it's designed to ricochet. It's very lively. It's going to bounce out of your hand, roll away. People get frustrated. You didn't ask me, Jim, but the difference between you and me in terms of how I became a juggler.
What is the difference between you and me in terms of how you became a juggler, Johnny?
When I drop, I pick it up again.
Very good.
But I'm pumped.
Very good.
Hey,
very
so
good.
Wait a second here. A couple of things. Then we're going to start the quiz. First of all, we're going to establish new rules today, which we've never done before. I didn't even tell you this.
Mm-hmm.
If you get a question right, you get a point. If you get a question right and are juggling while you're answering the question, you get 3 points. So there is an incentive to be juggling while answering it, and we'll find out if you guys are man or woman enough to do this. So... The thing that gets me really anxious about watching jugglers, I mean, who doesn't love jugglers, is the anxiety about worrying about whether or not you drop something. And then, even when you do, I don't mean you personally.
Oh, we never would drop. We never would do
that. But that isn't the ease with which you integrate that into your shtick.
Right.
Do you worry about dropping a thing?
Me,
like,
especially, personally, maybe more self-respecting jugglers would be more uptight about dropping and have more concern. But did I learn this from you, Peter? The difference between an amateur and a professional?
Is what?
We have one more joke ready to cover the drop.
Oh, okay.
And it's embarrassing, but it's not. It's humiliating for a magician to biff a trick if you expose that you're lying to an audience. We're not lying. We just made a mistake. And again, like Nick Walenda... he might die if he makes a mistake. A juggler, it hit the ground, it's embarrassing. You pick it up and do it again. The audience doesn't hate you, but they watch you pretty carefully. If you tighten up and are really upset by it, they're watching that because they can see how you're breathing. They can see if you're relaxed.
They're breathing with you.
Yeah, they can see what's going on.
I like that. Let's start the quiz if we can.
We're ready. I'll start. We'll do boy, girl, and then we'll go back and forth.
Okay, fine.
Peter, but why Peter Panic?
The boy that wouldn't grow up. You know, it's a play on Peter Pan.
Okay.
I mean, I'm a professional juggler. Do I look like a grown-up? You know?
Yes, pretty much an oxymoron.
So, but
or the regular kind.
It's a stage name.
But I'm bummed. Thank you very much.
Peter Panic isn't my real name.
I realize that. It's McLaughlin.
No, my real name is Sid Vicious.
Boy, Marjorie walked right into that baby, didn't she, Peter?
Okay.
Here's the first question.
Ready?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, is there a bell or something, or how do we do it?
We have no bells.
Oh, Peter is juggling as he's waiting. Now, you're not even getting a question here yet,
Oh, it's
Jenny.
His question?
But you can juggle if you want.
Right. Okay, a recent study from Harvard is good news, Peter, for those with a sweet tooth. Here's a clip.
A new study from Harvard says you can reduce the risk of a potentially fatal heart condition by eating six a week. Yeah, I know. It reduces the chance of a heart attack because once you give up being in shape, you have way less stress.
Okay, you can. Do you know what what you can reduce your risk of a fatal heart attack condition by eating six what?
I'm gonna guess chocolate bars.
Wow,
I really
you
don't know.
Are very good.
And by the way, he was juggling the whole time.
That was a guess.
Points. That
was
excellent.
Terrific. Excellent.
Okay.
Now, you're going to be doing juggling balls during this one? I guess she is. So, Jenny,
soccer
here's
balls.
The deal. The juice could soon be loose.
It's been reported that O.J. Simpson could be released from prison this year. Yeah. When he heard this, Donald Trump said, finally, someone to play golf with.
Now, what is O.J. as in Simpson in prison for, Jenny the Juggler? Do you know? She's juggling as we're speaking, and she's looking at
Well,
Peter.
I thought it was for killing Nicole Brown, but he was acquitted of that.
Yeah, so what did he do?
I don't know. It must have been, I don't know, tax evasion. I don't remember.
Give her a quarter of a point because she's
quarter.
Juggling while she's doing
guess.
It. Now, do you know what the answer to that question is?
Well, I believe it was kidnapping, and he stole sports memorabilia, but I think the charge was kidnapping because there was a weapon and he held someone hostage for a little bit.
Give him a point and a half. It was stealing sports memorabilia. Excellent. Very and juggling as you did it, by the way. That was excellent. So, what's the score at the end of one round? I'm totally confused.
A quarter
judges.
Of my point.
Quarter of a point for Jenny, and how about the other? Two and a half to a quarter.
Guys, so can you guys earn a living by being professional jugglers? Can you or do you have to have a side job?
I've been full time for 20 years.
Wow. And you as well, Peter?
I've been full-time for about 30 years.
Wow. And where do you go to job? I mean, I know you talk about Harvard Square, but...
30 years.
Where do you go?
I've been in 50 states. I went to China 5 times.
Wow.
Japan, Singapore. I mean, you have to travel a lot. But yeah. Boston is a nice town. The arts are supported here. And it's kind of a college town. It's not quite New York City or L.A., but it has a thriving arts community.
So who are your clients normally?
Different people. Like, I just did a parade for Memorial Day.
Neat.
In Newton.
Huh.
I'm doing a couple for 4th of July. I'm doing a solstice party.
How about you, Jenny?
So I also do a lot of family entertainment around the greater Boston, and I have a young family myself, so I like to stay around here, even though I've performed in England and Hawaii and California and the South. But so I do plenty of birthday parties. You can find me at JennyTheJuggler.com. And
Peter's at PeterPanic.com.
Yeah, but lots of other things. Like tomorrow I'll actually be the MC of the children's music stage at the Cambridge River Festival.
Oh, neat.
All day from 11 to 6. And then I do other stuff too, like balloon animals and face painting and stuff. So you can get more diverse work in different types of gigs to fill out the schedule.
Excuse me, you know we're here for a quiz.
I just want
to be clear.
I've seen people juggle fire things, right? What is it that they juggle? Is it
it's same?
A torch.
It's a torch. You have a wick that you dip it in something, and it's basically, if you can do this, you could juggle with fire or with knives.
But that could get you in trouble.
There's bad things that could happen.
There's rock bands. There's few venues where it's legal around here, so it's more like private events and stuff. I just did it twice this week.
Right.
What juggling did you juggle? Fire twice this week? Yeah, I was doing it last week, too. Okay, okay. So the end of one round, let's go to the second round, Marjorie. Peter gets
okay,
question.
Here you go, Peter. Go ahead, Peter. Another person of interest has been added this week in the ongoing FBI investigation into Trump's ties to Russia.
Government officials confirmed this afternoon that a person of interest in the FBI's Russia investigation is... This comes at a bad time because the Trump administration has just released their budget. And now they must be like, oh, we forgot to set aside bail money.
Okay. Which member of the Trump administration was named a person of interest this week?
Was it Ivanka's husband, Jared Kushner?
You are correct.
You are
that
roll.
Was unbelievable.
Yes.
Juggling the whole
as well.
Time.
Can you juggle with your eyes closed, or is the visual thing? Because I was watching you a second ago. Well, actually, you too. You weren't even looking at the things you right. were.
No, but we see it in our peripheral vision.
Oh,
and
you do.
That is a skill to juggle it with your eyes closed, but not one that I possess. Okay.
It's a lot of muscle memory, but it is possible. I don't know if Jared is part of the administration officially, though, is he?
Yeah, he's in charge of, like, peace in the Middle East
but
and solving the
opioid
problem.
Oh, wait a second. Give her a point for that, because she's right. He's in charge of everything.
Everything.
That's exactly
that's right.
right.
Yeah.
Okay, here's your question, Jenny. Let's try to do better than a quarter point this time,
thanks.
Right? This week, the White House released more details surrounding President Trump's trip to Europe. Here it is.
This is weird. While he was there, President Trump gave several books written by Martin Luther King. Then Trump said, in my opinion, this is what Trump said, in my opinion, King's best books were The Shining and Pet Sematary.
To whom did President Trump, did whom did the Pope? Whoops. Did who?
Oh,
did
I knew it, though. I was going to say the Pope. I knew that.
Okay, give her
I knew
points.
He was going to try to be impressing the Pope and they exchanged gifts. That's what I was going to say.
Give her 11 points for that because
okay.
I really screwed up the
okay.
Whatever.
Thanks,
kind of
though, but
how
I
long
did know
could,
that.
If I said to you, which I'm about to, just juggle till you don't juggle. How long could you juggle? Talking to you,
I juggle for Fenway Park. Game opening, like when the gate opens an hour and a half before the park. So from the time the gate opens until first pitch, I'm juggling the whole, practically the whole time.
Oh my
gosh!
How about
you? What's the deal with
you? I'm not
you?
Saying I don't switch it up or maybe stop and chat with a fan, but yeah.
The world record is 11 hours.
And how close to 11 hours could you come?
I one time did 5 balls for 37 minutes.
Oh my god.
That's the other thing.
It's
okay.
Painful.
So you guys have 3 each of what you got here today,
yeah.
but you can move up to do 4 things, 5 things.
Sure.
I mean, I would do more than 4, but I don't like to show off like
okay.
some people.
That's a nice joke.
But is there like a record for how many things people can keep up in the air?
You can
what
look
is
it up
11?
On YouTube. 11. There's
11.
A guy that has done 37 throws with 11. They're like foot bags or very small bean bags.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So, and what else do you do besides the other things you do juggle in your when you're performing besides whatever?
I ride unicycles. I juggle large size balls. I have knives or torches or a lot of. I never went with the chainsaws, but there's a lot of the
chainsaws.
There are people that do that. A lot of people. It's about thrill and danger, and then after a while, it's just eye candy. It's a fun thing to look at. Hopefully, it's not gonna. Save the world or change the world. It's just lowbrow entertainment.
Do you teach you too as well?
Sure.
Like as in juggling? Okay, fine.
I've started teaching. I've just started taking on students now.
Okay, so how long would it take you, and don't say now, because I don't even how long would it take either of you to teach me how to juggle? I am totally uncoordinated.
It really is up to you. Like, we could give you, you have to teach yourself, but you could learn in a few days. And it's a YouTube world now. There's all kinds of tutorials online.
In a few days, I could be juggling three things?
Well, I find that having a real live person give you live feedback on what your body is doing. Everybody's body has weird quirks where their maybe left hand is throwing forward every time. That's a stumbling block. So as a quote teacher, I can help give that feedback and give them tools to correct for those quirks better than a YouTube video, but it does come down to you practicing a few minutes every day.
Marjorie and I are thinking of signing
purpose.
Up. Why do you have a look on your face like
well,
that? What's the problem with you? Why
you juggling?
I didn't say. I would try to juggle.
Right. No, you could definitely do it. Anyone could learn to do it.
They can.
Don't take this the wrong way. It's easier to learn things when you're young.
Yeah.
Well, I do take
a lot of muscle memory.
Thank you very
no,
much.
You know.
Can you deduct a point?
Let me tell you, I actually do deduct 2 points for that offensive comment. Thank you for suggesting it, Jenny.
Anytime.
Now, judges, before we go into the bonus round, what is the score, please? 5.5 to 4.25.
We have a lot of,
so you're really in the action here. Now, jugglers are known to here's the bonus round, people. No, jugglers are known to juggle with all sorts of dangerous items, as we just heard, including flaming pins, knives, even loaded guns. Without doubt, though, everyone's favorite is the dreaded chainsaw. As you just said, Peter, as expert jugglers, we wanted to test Jenny and Pete's knowledge of a juggler's most infamous prop, the chainsaw. That's the subject of our quiz. Now, the first question from you this time
is
girl, boy, Jenny, the juggler.
I did not know that chainsaws were the favorite.
By
the
way, when I was young, I juggled chainsaw. I haven't done it in years, but I can do five, actually, Jenny. It was amazing. And with my eyes closed, that's true.
Okay, here we go, Jenny. And
sometime.
These are all hard, but they're multiple choice.
Okay, go ahead.
The first known chainsaw-like tool has been traced back to the 1830s in Germany. What was it originally used for? A, to cut down trees. B, as a tool for bakers to slice through dense black forest cake. Or C, as a medical device that orthopedists used to cut through bone.
Ooh, she's sighing on this one.
I'm going to go with C. Wait. When was the date?
Stick with your answer, I would
okay,
say.
Okay, C.
C, excellent.
Good. C.
A medical device that orthopedists used to cut through bone is correct.
And juggling.
That's
I'm
going
to try to help. And she was juggling, so she gets 6 points for that or something. Chainsaw manufacturer Stihl, as in S-T-I-H-L, he's juggling, introduced a revolutionary feature to their chainsaws, as I'm sure you know, Peter, in 1964. What was it? A, an anti-vibration handle. B, a friction-reducing chain called the Fritz in honor of the creator's father. He was a mean father, too. And C, a push button to start the chainsaw that replaced the start cord. An anti-vibration handle, a friction-reducing chain, or a push button. A, B, or C. Please, Peter, panic.
I'm going to just guess A.
Wow. Excellent.
That
and
was
you
very
were
good.
You were doing the juggling thing, too. Kind of. You know what? Also, I have a
question.
You guys
are really good. This
you
is
are
unbelievable.
Really good.
Yeah.
I just can't believe you can also live and do things. But, you know, the interesting thing to me is you are juggling something that you
they can live.
Well,
they
whatever.
Can live.
You know what I mean.
Yeah. So
you
I have no idea
are
what you
grasping
meant.
The item that do you actually catch it or do you not catch it? When
you want to try it? You just sort of
no,
put your hand out and it slaps into your hand. It just, again, muscle memory. If you've done this 1,000 times, it's easy. It's hard doing it the first time.
We're sort of catching it for a nanosecond.
Right.
But the reason I brought it up is you're not catching those, are you or are you?
I
well,
am
sort of
kind
are.
Of cradling them.
Okay.
I can juggle balls bigger than this. It's not as fun for me. I can palm this ball.
Oh, I love that.
So,
ooh.
You know.
Ooh.
Whoa! Excuse me.
Wow.
Here, I'll use my head.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yes.
Here. Oh, you guys like puns? You like puns? All right, here. I'll put my best foot forward.
Whoa.
Oh, my goodness. That's great.
Wait a second. The show's over?
The show's over.
Oh, no.
Oh, well, let's declare it a tie. You two are fabulous. Jenny the Juggler and Peter Panic.
That was
let's hear
wonderful.
It for them.
That was
thank
wonderful.
You so
thank
much,
you so
guys.
Much. It was great
yeah,
to be here.
Thank you very much for coming
so
here.
We forgot. We're going to give you a website.
Yeah, we're going to give you websites.
Go ahead.
PeterPanic.com, and Panic is P-A-N-I-C.
Yeah,
otherwise
the website
panic.
Isn't much, so go to YouTube and look me up on YouTube.
YouTube, okay.
Excellent,
Peter Panic on YouTube. JennyTheJuggler.com, is
yes.
that what you want? JennyTheJuggler.com, and it's Jenny with a Y. Jenny the Juggler and Peter Panic, thank you very much.
It was
really fun to have
you
guys here. And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in on Monday. Dr. Marcia Angel will join us for her take on the state of healthcare in America and what its future could be. She's a very famous physician, and she was with the Journal of what is it called? The
JAMA, Journal of American
thank you very
Medical
much.
Association.
Charlie Sennett weighs in, too, on the Paris climate, and Bob Thompson gives us his roundup on TV. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Molly Boycon, Christina Bieni, our engineer John the Claw Parker, our production at WGBH. Emily Rooney's on at 7 o'clock
well,
tonight.
Well, but I want to say, well, I'm not on tonight.
Jared
on
Bowen, 8:30 on his open studio
on Greater Boston on
yes.
Monday night.
Yes,
not tonight. I will be juggling chainsaws. So I would tune in at 7 o'clock. You're gonna have to help me over the
yeah,
weekend.
Yeah, okay, that'll be good. Okay.
Thank you all for coming too.
Thank
we
you
really
very much, people
at
Boston Public Library. Thank you for tuning in. Have a wonderful weekend, and please tune in again on Monday. Bye.